to Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy, third time's a charm. Is it too early for Thorazine cocktails on a Friday evening? I have no idea what just happened. Everything's all right, and all the things are in their happy places, and you press all the buttons, and... Now, it's kind of like watching the Millennium Falcon try to go into warp or something. Oh, not again, Chewie. Only on a Friday. Well, you know what this means? Last night I had this feeling that, it was going to be a really good show. Tonight, I don't know. I may punch the phone button and just have little bats fly through the air. I need a keeper. I need a handler. I need a staff. You know what we need. I'm not starting the show that way again. I just wanted to go take a bath after last. I hate starting the show with a money pitch. Urgh, yuck! Haldol shooters for everybody. Oh well. Now there's some fun stuff to go into this evening, especially after the way I closed the show last night. But I tell you, it's Friday. And rather than me sitting here and babbling my fool head off, this is live, by the way. This is accept no substitutes, and don't try this at home. I am a trained broadcaster. So with that in mind, light up the phones. It's Friday. That's what Friday's for. Anything that I miss during the week, you bring. The only difference is it's not open phones Friday. Open phones are every day. But if there's something that's just don't fall over you and you can't. Weekend's coming, man. You get it out now, or it percolates and boils around inside you like, you know, and, you know, when it finds, you know what I mean. So let's go to the phones. I do think our critic at large, Reverbo, is with us. Still there, Reverbo, or did you give up?
No, I'm still here. I was enjoying the classical music coming out of my computer, listening to your
Everybody minuet.
I hate to pile on your memory here, but, you know, 500,000 jobs were lost in November.
I know. Saw that.
And I was wondering if some of those pink slips weren't issued to the possums that were on that treadmill powering your station.
I know that times are hard.
What are the names of those two little guys? Was it Heckle and Jekyll? Or
Chip and Dale and...
Hell yeah. 500,000. I remember over the summer there were people were talking about, and this was stunning to me, 50,000, 80,000 jobs lost. And in November now we're talking 500,000. I can't even get my head around that figure.
Pick a city. Let's see, that 500,000, Reverbo, that's almost half of West Virginia.
It's all of Alaska.
Well, it's all of Alaska and several times over.
those unemployment figures don't really tell the whole story because people like me, I've been out of work since, I lost my job a year ago. But, I mean, I'm not, people who aren't, don't have a paper trail, who aren't drawing unemployment,
isn't that what the Bush administration refers to as discouraged workers?
I believe I'm a discouraged worker, indeed. That's a way they massage all their their figures to make it seem like.
You want the worst part of the news, Reverbo? 500,000 is what came out, you know, now. The Bush Labor Department revises in the next month the last month's numbers, and I think with very few exceptions, if any, every blessed revision the following month has been worse than the month before. In other words, back in 2004 when he was running for re-election, they'd say, well, the Bush administration economy added 40,000 jobs, and the next month they'd say, well, no, it was really 15. And so I fully expect that by the time January rolls around, this 500,000 will probably be 600,000.
I mean, once you start talking about 500,000 jobs in one freaking month, this is like depression numbers. Now, I don't know this. What was the? I don't know how they kept any of this these figures in the 20s or in the 30s. But what was the unemployment rate in say 1934?
Oh God, I read that just the other day, and it was, it was double digits. It was 20% getting up. Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it could easily, throwing in the discouraged worker. We could easily be hitting, people think, like 8 or 9% instead.
Well, but wait a minute. Remember, starting with the Reagan administration, Reverbo, the numbers that we have now may be that number. Because the Reagan administration, I believe, if not them, the Bush administration, were the ones who really started dummying up the numbers. Because they include the military now.
I don't understand. The military don't they have a job being military?
No. Back in the day, the military was not included in American employment figures. The Reagan administration, the godless, soulless, motherless, repig lickens, included the military in the employment numbers so that they could pad them and make them look better than what they were, so that right-wing idiots could get on the TV box and say, America's ambassador to God, Ronald Reagan, has increased employment. When what they did was they dummied up the numbers.
So he would take the overall unemployment figures, and he would just goose it. He would subtract from that anyone who was in the volunteer army.
Well, no, he would take the what happens is you take the number of people who are employed versus unemployed, and you add in the military as being employed persons.
I see.
And therefore, the unemployed number goes down.
These people are just pros at talk about massaging.
Well, you know, it's no different from anything. It's no different from anything else these miserable bastards have done. If you think about. The Bush administration trying to reclassify kids working at McDonald's as hamburger technicians and putting them into the manufacturing sector because that's been tanking forever.
Wow. It never occurred to me that...
They did that.
Cheeseburger was actually being crafted by a technician.
Yeah.
Well, what they did was they fooled us all into thinking that the entire economy, for the last 20 years was... going great.
But exactly, this is how they operate, Reverbo. Part of the reason so many the pension and retirement programs in this country for employed persons is in such a wreck is that you used to have guaranteed pension plans. They were called pensions.
Yeah.
But then because of a seemingly innocuous blip in the tax code, the 401k was leveraged, and all of a sudden, all the employers said, well, look, we can get rid of our pensions. This is great. We're going to Jamaica. And so you've got 401ks, and what that the general effect of that was to take all that money and shove it, into the markets. See, the Republicans can't, for all their free market BS, they can't play in it. They always have to dummy it up.
Well, no one would buy into it if they told you the truth about it. Who would ever vote for them? I mean, their whole position is you know, elect, here's, please elect me. I want to be your representative so that instead of representing you, I will just make money for me and my friends, and I don't care what happens to you. So how many people going to vote for me? They can't do that. No one, they can't do that. So they got to, you know who their base is. You know who they recruit to help them out. And
sure.
They're just lying sacks of shit, all of them.
Yeah, they are. You know, and I've looked through my little inbox, and I'm looking at an email now. Give Ronald Reagan for Christmas. Because I get the right wing, you know, little blast. Give Ronald Reagan for Christmas.
Oh,
no. And, but the Digby, the blogger Digby, I caught an excerpt of this over at Crooks and Liars, said something that is very, very profound. And I was just awfully damned impressed by what I saw. And that is the notion that progressives have to, or what I call liberals, have to talk about the fact that liberals are fixing things. And that may seem sort of overly simplistic, but there's truth in it, because the right wing, as Digby notes, has this ugly habit of lying and repackaging and rebranding. Here it is. Progressivism needs progressive rhetoric to match policy if it wants to be around long enough to make a real impact. If Democrats make things better without making it clear that their ideology is superior, the country will simply continue to treat politics like entertainment and vote for whoever puts on the best show and makes them feel good about themselves at a particular time, irrespective of their policies. And that's part and parcel, you know, of what we're trying to do here. What, you know, what we do when we talk to folks in the grocery store line or at the post office or while we're pumping gas. Because all the right wing ever does is repackage a bunch of stupid old nonsense garbage and wrap a flag around it and hang a cross over it. And you got to vote for this. See, it's got a flag and a cross.
Yeah, I really say that's how fascism becomes wrapped in America. That old.
Yeah.
Up in Sinclair Lewis line or whatever. But you're talking about the difference between what you're trying to do. You're talking about, you're using a word like educate. They're trying, we need to, the liberals need to educate the citizens that there is a right way to go and a wrong way to go.
Yeah, well, there's two C-A-T-E words. There's what we use, and that's educate, C-A-T-E. And then there's what the Republicans do, and that's obfuscate.
Perfect distinction. Well, it's easy to be lost. Get lost in that when you're not. Yes, in the back, educated.
Yeah,
when
exactly.
We don't like no one thanks to.
But no, I've looked at this 500,000, and you know, you see a number like that, Reverbo, and your eyes cross a little bit, and you feel that sort of burning sensation, and you know, and it's Excedrin headache number, Avogadro's number. And you wonder if we're getting close to the time that we really have to start playing, you know, oldies but goodies like this in earnest. The late, great Rudy Valley. Gotta love this vocal. If we ever get to it, this is the intro from hell. Here we go.
This is Rudy Valley again, stepping perhaps a bit out of character and singing a song from Americana. A song that has taken its audiences by storm, which may be explained by its theme, which is both poignant and different. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Here we go. Maybe.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job.
Wow, Reverbo, what a line.
Jeez.
And I always followed the mob. Yeah, I mean, what else? It's the Reagan Revolution. All them Democrats down south, they're Reagan Democrats now. What do you call that if that's not following the mob? You know, when the mob said, I like George W. Bush, I want to have a beer with him. Follow the mob. Now I ain't got no job. Bob. Yeah.
Kind of robs with rhymes with mob, don't it?
Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it?
Oh, my. Well, we're going to get around to that rhetoric before I end my call. And I'm going to change canoes here on you for a minute, because I think of all the people, you know the answer to this better than any of us. I was listening to NPR today. They have a great show called Science Friday. They had this guy on, a professor from Berkeley, who was talking about, he was referencing our new president-elect and how Obama was said that he was going to take a look at everything in this whole energy revolution, job creation plan of his, and he was going to figure out where the best place would be to pump in the money and to crank up the resources. And of course, he's talking about, he uses the phrase clean coal. He uses the phrase, of course, again, nuclear power. And the guy says, well, you know, and hey, don't get me wrong, I think Obama should look at every damn thing there is to look at. I mean, I mean that's why I like the guy. He's intellectually interested, and he also has got a brain in his head. But I also don't want him to get lost in the lobby, in the checkbook wilderness of fantasy land here either. And so my question to you is, is there such a thing as clean coal, and is it just a matter of writing a big enough check, or is it technologically bogus?
It's not just technological. Okay, slowly. Not because of you, but because of me, because I hear clean coal, my eyes roll back in my head, my blood boils, my toes curl, you know, hairs grow backward into my skin, and I just lose it. Clean coal is an advertising slogan. It is not a technology. If you and I say, oh, I don't know, hairspray technology is more scientific than clean coal technology. Any technology, because it's not a technology. I can't say that plainly enough. It is an advertising slogan. If you do the history on it, you will find that the coal mavens and coal barons and coal sluggards were babbling about clean coal in like 1905. Because even then they were recognized. You ever seen a photograph, Reverbo, and there's a very famous one, of Pittsburgh in like, 1924 or something?
No, is it like the Welsh coal miners? Just these people, just black skies, black faces.
It's very famous. It was shot, and I'll bet you somebody out there will have me a link to it in a minute. Yeah, because pictures do me so much good on radio.
Soot covered.
It was shot on Forbes Avenue, and I think there's a clock in it that shows what time it is. And it's like noon or 2 p.m. or something, and it looks like night. And that far back, people realized what the burning of coal was doing to their cities. In fact, I've even read, and perhaps it's anecdotal, Reverbo, that some of the early just sort of things passing through Charles Darwin's mind that led him to contemplate natural selection and the origin of species was the fact that in the Industrial Revolution England, that he saw pigeons who were one color, but then after a couple of generations living in coal soot, they were another because they were adapting to their environment. It may be anecdotal, but I could swear I read something along those lines somewhere.
No, it was, but it was moths or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
But yes, you're right. He was trying to show that there was a, they were mutating to adapt to their environment because of the but what I was wondering was, and I know there's enough, you know, I was just wondering if there is in fact, are there in fact people who are trying to
there really are people who are working on it, and the people who are working on it, Yeah, you don't even have to get them liquored up or fire them up with sodium pentothal or anything. They'll tell you straight up, dead sober, that they're 30 years away from anything approaching being able to make clean, so-called clean coal.
That's what I wanted.
And that even when they do that, it's as Cossack's pointing out in the chat room, it is so water intensive that you just can't do it without a net loss. So that all presupposes that it doesn't matter how we get it out of the ground. Because there's no way to cleanly mine coal. There are more responsible ways and less responsible ways, but the coal is under the ground because just in terms of the geologic means by which it was formed, there's all kinds of poisons there.
Yeah,
it's really a Pandora's box.
Right, it's a mess getting it out, and it's a mess using it for fuel. But it might have
a- and it's a mess dealing with the aftermath. Even after you've burned it, it's the gift that keeps on taking lives.
Yeah. Well, I know how close this is to you and West Virginia and all of that. But you hear these people, and I was thinking, well, what, this guy doesn't have a dog in the fight. What is this? Is just interesting hearing him say. He goes, and nuclear waste, the disposal problem's been solved. And I'm thinking, where? I haven't heard that.
Yeah, tell that to the people at Yucca Mountain.
Well, I mean, do you shoot it off into outer space? Is that how you solve the problem? Problem solved. I mean, you know, I thought that we...
Yeah, bury it on the ocean floor down there with that squid with the elbows.
Well, I don't know.
Now, I don't think that's going to work either.
I don't think so either, but there's going to be a lot of pressure. I want him to explore everything, but I want him to make the right decisions. And that's why I was wondering, is there, you know, if there was a way to do this, it was kind of like the perpetual motion machine. It would be fantastic if there was a way to mine coal, you know, safely and burn coal cleanly. And evidently there is no such way.
No, because whether you take it by mountaintop removal or by underground, and frankly, if I've got to choose between the two, I want it mined underground. You're still turning loose toxins that you virtually can't control. For instance, just walking, there's a little rail trail here. It used to be a railroad, now it's a walking path. Beautiful place, but it was a heavily mined area, Reverbo. And in fact, when Jen and Michael were shooting video here last month. We were shooting down that trail, and I just came to a place, and you know, there's this hole that's been deliberately caved in the side of the mountain. It's a drift mouth. And then there's a culvert under the trail, and there's water just dribbling down into a beautiful little mill creek. But I pointed at something on the stone, and I said, do you know what that stuff is, guys? And it was this big orange splotch from where the water had been running over. And what that is acid mine drainage. Water happens with coal mining. And with coal mining, the water that comes out is toxic. Not just a little bit. And that's a mine that's been shut down for 60, 70, 80 years, and it is still dribbling acid that's dribbling on into a creek that feeds into the New River.
That's dandy.
Yeah, and in modern terms, it's damn near impossible to keep that from happening there too. So you know, no matter how you get it, you get problems, and they're virtually insurmountable problems. You know, the scientists like to talk about things like carbon capture and carbon sequestration, and that, you know, that's where you take all the carbon that's left over from the coal burning process. And you pump it underground or something. And I think one of the folks down at Coal River Mountain Watch calculated a few months ago that 1 year's supply of the carbon emissions from all the coal-fired plants just in West Virginia would require an underground space the size of West Virginia to sequester the carbon.
Well, that's absurd.
But that's what they're working on. The carbon sequestration and carbon capture, and even, you know, the thing that gets probably more play among most the environmentally turned folks is not carbon capture and carbon sequestration, but cap and trade.
Yeah.
And frankly, that won't work either. We simply have to get to the point where we whether it's sequestration or cap and trade or any of that stuff, it's all the equivalent of the drunk who says, you know, I got to get off the vodka. And so instead of drinking a fifth of vodka a day, he drinks a case of beer.
That works through a lot of them for a while, yeah.
But it really is the same thing. And sooner or later, just as with the drunk, where things like carbon are concerned, we have to get to that sober up intervention point where you repeat that first line from AA. I am powerless over alcohol.
Yeah.
I'm powerless over coal. And the only way to get well from coal and get well from carbon, hydrocarbons of, you know, oil, gas, is to stop using it.
Abstinence. There's a word. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Works with sex. Not so much. Yeah.
There you go. Well, and we're talking about the whole thing. I don't want to live in a world that you know, we're going to have the county dump is so poisonous and so huge and so full of nuclear and petroleum and coal waste that essentially, you know, like, well, that isn't going to work either. You have to have renewable resources. There's no other way. And so what we got to have these companies have to figure out a way to get on board with it. Okay, you can make money delivering it to me, but you're not going to make any money anymore pumping it out, because it's coming from the sky or coming from the wind.
Oh, there are so many things that you've made.
You've got a way to make money on it, and that's fine. But, you know, otherwise we're just going to, you know, it's like a huge methane bomb. We're going to just blow ourselves up with waste.
Well, for instance, the city dump, any city dump, there are environmental regulations that say it's got to be lined with this and it's got to be impermeable and blah, 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 so that you can't just leach garbage juice into the local water supply. Well,
I'm okay with George Jr. if you do that, but go on.
Yeah, well, he'd drink it with a straw. That's why his brain's
sure.
The way it is.
Sure.
Well, you go up here, for instance, and by the way, I heard some blasting today, and that's never a pleasant sound. You go up here on the mountain about 2 miles, 2-3 miles as the crow flies from where I'm broadcasting now, and they've got And you can see them from on Google Earth. They're visible from space, these great big lakes of poisonous sludge that take up thousands upon thousands of acres. Because, again, you got stuff you got to deal with, and you can't just, you know, put it into a stream. And it's really, you can't get rid of it. But anyway, these things, they're usually behind earthen, you know, dirt mud dams. That's what they like to call them, earthen dams, as if it, you know, that's environmental, isn't it? No, they're mud, they're dirt dams. And they hold back billions of gallons of toxic sludge. And that stuff just percolates into the earth. And it destroys all manner of water supplies. And what's even more fun is the EPA says that they're in the Department of Environmental Protection here says, well, you know, they every time they get to 60% full of sediment. Oh, sediment. That's like sand, isn't it? Not really. It's poison. They have to scoop it out, to scoop the sediment out and take it somewhere else. Well, somewhere else is somewhere else on the site, and theoretically they're just going to rebury it. It don't work that way. So
none of it works.
No.
It's a flawed plan from the get-go.
Yeah, and it's flawed because it hasn't been conceived as a means of protecting anybody's local communities. It's been conceived as the most cost-effective way to skirt what few environmental regulations these coal companies are willing to tolerate. Because again, for the last 8 years, and any time a Republican gets in office, the people doing the enforcement work are actually old coal company executives. And so the coal companies get to tell the former coal company executives with whom they've, you know, gotten drunk, gone out, gone whoring, whatever, we can live with this regulation because we've found a way to get around it. And that's one of the things I'm seeing that one of the leading choices or one of the leading candidates now for head of the EPA is, I can't remember her name right offhand, but she was born and raised in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And she holds a master's degree in environmental education or environmental engineering from Princeton and is a former EPA head in that state, in New Jersey. And
she's got potential. She's good.
I don't know, but the one thing that speaks in her favor is that she, unlike a Bush-type choice, they're not coming straight from some polluting industry. She's more of an academic.
Oh, that would be a change. That kind of gets into this other thing that I was. Where I was going, and just tell me I'm all wrong on this, but, you know, I'm heading down into that horrible black hole of conspiracies, and, you know, I worked for Obama, or volunteered for him, and so I'm on there, I'm on his, I continue to be on his email in their loop. I mean, millions of us are still in their loop. And the other day, I got an email that said, basically, send more money and get a thoughtful Obama holiday mug.
Saw that. Yeah. Got that one, too.
Okay, and so I started thinking to myself, so this is what they're planning on doing. You know, this is the new, they're not Democrats, they're cybercrats. And they're going to work this for all it's worth. They're going to milk this gold mine of you know, internet-connected supporters indefinitely.
Well, look, it's part of the one of the more flawed parts of our system. A, we've got this dirty political money system, and B, apparently the old school used to be that the first term president started running for his second term the moment after he was inaugurated. Well, recognizing what Republicans do and how and the money access that they have, I surmise that the Barack Obama's people have realized it's far better to get a head start. Get that email list expanded now.
Man, they're just getting drunk with this power. Of course, you know, he rewrote the whole book on fundraising, you know, $60 and $70 from millions of us. It just it worked like a dream. Everybody was so passionate about it. And that's when I started, I don't like going here. So what you need to do is tie a rope around me because we're going to lower me in. Down, way down in there. But in 2 minutes, if I'm not, you don't hear from me, pull me out, okay?
Yeah.
I suddenly got real jaded and concerned about things. And I was thinking a lot of this had to do with studying Obama's, some of his appointments. Like, we're not really getting John Maynard Keynes, are we? We're sort of getting friends of Larry Summers.
I did see something inspiring today, Reverbo, and that is this, or at least it appears inspiring on its face, this individual that Joe Biden has tapped to be his economic advisor. And he's fairly well respected. He is, let's see, what's his name? Jared Bernstein. Director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute, and he is known as a progressive economist. And he's going to be chief economist and economic policy advisor to Joe Biden.
I think he's hooked up with that guy from Citibank or Citicorp, Robert Rubin. But, I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. He knows more than we do. He's a very smart guy.
Well, here's a few of his words that he's written. And, of course, this guy isn't going to, you know, he's not going to be the guy that everybody goes to first, but at least he's a voice. He has said, regarding the variables that matter most to working families, the neocon experiment was a particularly dramatic failure. Employment grew one-third as fast as the average over the 2000s business cycle, and the unemployment rate, though low on average, was higher at the end of the cycle than at the beginning. Perhaps the most damning indictment is this. For the first time on record, going back to the mid-1940s, the income of the typical middle American family was slightly lower last year than at the prior peak in 2000. And he goes on and he says, the neocons have had their turn and they failed. It's our turn now.
Sounds good.
He's got previous experience as the deputy chief economist for the Department of Labor, and he served on the Congressional Budget Office's advisory committee. So,
that's better
than having some Milton Friedman clone out there screaming, "Screw the workers!"
Oh, it is, it is. And this guy Geithner, who's the new Treasury Secretary, is he's from the new state of New York. Branch of the Federal Reserve or whatever.
Yeah, he was the New York Fed, chief, I think.
But he sounds like he also is may not be in anybody's pocket. But I started thinking about. I know in the dead of night you think about this too. What if they were all really evil geniuses, Bob? What if they were working on crafting another scam on all of us? What if we were ripe for another con?
But we don't have anything to pay for the next con with. I mean, we're all tapped out.
Well, this is where I was going with this. And again, if you can't hear me, you won't talk.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Now, I'm talking about the puppet masters here. I'm talking about the real terrorists, the ones that have been around basically crafting the world and the future since, what, the 1400s? You know these people, the ones with all the freaking gold, those
right.
People.
Yes.
The ones who don't give a damn whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. They don't care. They're the terrorists. They're the economic. They're the people that, you know. And so I started thinking they knew they couldn't win the White House back in 06, right? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I've said all along, Rivrobo, that the Republicans did not want the White House in 08.
I don't think it was available to them.
Well,
you're not going to win with those two nitwits. I mean, come on.
Well, some of this stuff, and I don't know if any of this is going to make any sense, but when George Bush in 2000 chose Darth Cheney to be his vice president, You said, and even some of the for-profit media gurus said, well, obviously this man will not run for election on the coattails of an outgoing president.
Well, that's true.
I don't think they wanted it in 08. They had, you know, they had to put up a show. They had to raise some money. But honest to God, maybe...
Look, I don't want to go here, and I can't breathe down here. But all I can tell you is that in this crazy darkness down
here, don't light a match.
You guarantee the loss. The plan worked out great. You run a couple of nitwits who don't stand a chance, and you deliberately engineer your defeat, but you ensure the real victory because it's the gold. Stupid.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to haul you up or get down there with you.
God. You know, the only person who can appreciate this is Terry Southern. If you wrote The Magic Christian, I wish you were alive to see this because you just start thinking there's no difference. I mean, there's no policy differences between the two parties. It's all irrelevant.
But we will, I think we will see some differences. The question is one of degree. Politics, at least American politics, is such that, and I think you can say this generally throughout the industrialized or, you know, first world, whatever you want to call it. Radical change only comes as a forestaller of violent revolution. So that you see degrees of incrementalism. The New Deal, at the time of the New Deal, it had only been a little over 10 years since Eugene V. Debs mounted a significant presidential campaign that scared the piss out of both political parties. Okay? By the time Huey Long, during the first Roosevelt administration, Huey Long was down in Louisiana penning tunes like things like "Every Man a King," and introducing concepts of what we would recognize as a sort of nascent Social Security that went a hell of a lot further than Social Security has ever gone. And that idea was watered down into Social Security. And then Huey Long got all dead. So that's sort of the arc of American politics, isn't it? I mean, you're not gonna see radical change, but you can see changes in the way problems are thought about. And you're seeing some of that in the emergence of the people talking more and more. And the Republicans hard pressed to use their tired old talking points against it. People talking, you know, Paul Krugman saying what we do right now is we spend and damn the cost, and we'll deal with the inflation later because we can. But you have to spend your way out of this mess.
I believe our friend Mark Levine believes in the same thing.
He does indeed. And there's a lot to recommend it. The question is where you spend the money.
That's essentially the difference between the two parties, too. One party has always spent the money on defense, on the Pentagon, and the other party has typically spent the money on social programs.
But now where the whole macro economy is concerned, Reverbo, when you see, well, the essence of the whole debate is encapsulated in the difference between how we treated Wall Street and how we treated Woodward Avenue. You know, Woodward Avenue is, unless I'm mistaken, the main drag through Detroit. Wall Street came in, and they had everything but dancing girls and how much money do you want?
Well, Wall Street had moles in this infecting the system, always has. I used to think that Detroit had moles, too, but I guess they weren't bigger and big enough, smelly enough.
Well, they did have those moles. I forget who the Michigan senator was back decades ago who was referred to as the distinguished gentleman from General Motors.
Yeah.
Well, no, this is the guy who killed the Tucker. Remember that movie?
What's good for GM is good for the country.
Right, exactly. And even I guess Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford, said, you know, we used to have a real bad attitude. We used to say, we build it and they'll come. And that's just simply plain old fashioned not true anymore. So you see there is a philosophical debate. It's not on the broad spectrum that you and I might like to see, but there is a philosophical debate taking place right now. And what is most disturbing to me is this idea that it's okay to let 3 million people lose their jobs.
It's okay as of the end of discussion today. I've been following this every day, and it doesn't look like anything's going to happen. And Bush won't budge on everybody wants a piece of this pie somehow. And then, yeah, you're right, in the meantime, you got millions of workers hanging in the balance of this.
Meanwhile, you've got one of those right wing outfits whose stupid little emails I get. I get an email today with the subject line, "The ubiquitous stench of big government."
Oh God! Well, are they referring to George Jr.?
No. They're referring to that Muslim communist who's going to become president.
I don't know if anybody can. Bush raised the bar so high on that. I don't know if anybody can touch that.
They conveniently forget it. It's like this apparent cocktail party discussion that happened last night or night before last at Dick Cheney's Christmas party, where I forget who it was. Well, Chris Wallace was part of it. You know, that little pimple in the ass of the world. Chris Wallace got into it with Ron Howard. Oh, and it was no, it wasn't. Okay, it was this past Monday at a screening of the Howard's new film Frost Nixon.
Right.
Chris Wallace gets into it with Ron Howard because Ron Howard said that George Bush was similar to the crimes of Richard Nixon. And Chris Wallace just had a purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy and said that Ron Howard was engaging in a gross misreading of history because Bush didn't abuse his power for pure political self-preservation like Nixon.
For a minute, I was disoriented, and I thought you were actually going to say, no, he was trying to argue that he was worse. But no.
No. And now, as a result of this little story going around, Chris Wallace has been promised one of those exit interviews that George is going around giving, like that stunning thing he did with Charlie Gibson. I mean, is Charlie Gibson getting a little bit worried about the fact that he's becoming known as the guy who asks embarrassingly stupid questions of embarrassingly stupid politicians?
I'll tell you, George Jr. is appearing so disoriented anymore. I think you hit the nail on the head last night. I think this guy's just been on a bender for decades. And it's all, I mean, he's close to the edge.
Well, did you hear that line in the Gibson? Well, when I became in president.
Yeah, he's.
What?
It's embarrassing. It's really embarrassing. I don't know. Anyway, the conspiracy theorist in me was starting to get worried about all the rhetoric and thinking about how the world really works, you know?
I can see the moving hand of Repiglic and worker hate so obviously in all of this, Reverbo, that it sort of backburners some of this stuff, because if they can, and even understanding the concessions that the United Auto Workers have made, and their brutal concessions. Yeah, there are members of the UAW who are working for $14 an hour and have nothing in the way of health care and no job bank for their layoff. Okay?
Oh, yeah, that thing you read last night
right.
was just appalling. Yeah.
This is a chance. If the Republicans can just get their way and convince the Senate and convince the House and get enough so-called conservative Democrats with them on it, they can break the UAW forever. And if they break the UAW, they'll break every other union.
That's the last union left, isn't it? With the exception of, like, David Letterman's union.
Yeah, I mean, you know, SEIU has more members and so forth, but this is the last great industrial union. And if they can kill them, well, then even when we get the Employee Free Choice Act, assuming that we do, we start trying to sow seed on salted ground. How's that?
That is fairly well put. I frankly don't know what they're going to do about the auto companies. I think they're just going to probably loan them money till the spring. Well, until the UAW contract talks come rolling around again.
Right, and they'll hang back. They'll keep bankruptcy hanging like a sword of Damocles.
Right, right.
I would.
That one guy from Chrysler, he says something like, "Well, here's an idea I got. I was thinking about is how about if we all check? You give us the money and everything, and we'll just check back in with you, say around the end of March, and you can see how everything is going." But boy, you just God, how soon can I give you the money?
Just put it in a little brown paper bag in small unmarked bills.
I mean, I think someone said, maybe it was Keynes, who and he wasn't being tongue-in-cheek. It you could do more in times like this by giving all of us, right, our share of $700 billion. It would work better and more efficiently to just do that so we could, like, get out of debt, help pay off, get right side up on our house, help put our kids to school, recapitalize our little businesses or whatever, then by just, you know, giving our kids money to the billionaires on Wall Street who got in over their head. You that would make more sense. It would work better. It would get the country out of the gutter faster.
See, but like you, I want this change thing to be a reality and not merely an advertising slogan. I don't have much tolerance. We started out talking about clean coal as an advertising slogan. I don't have much tolerance anymore for advertising slogans. You know, you can sell me poop and tell me that it tastes like rose water, but it's still poop. And the only difference is marketing. And
I don't like
500,000 out of work in 1 month, wait till it's 3 million in a month. And that's what happens if this little bailout doesn't go through. And you know, we're talking about a loan. The Wall Street didn't even talk about loans. They, you know, give us the money. Give us the money, damn it.
No, I'll admit that, you know, if you gave some of us the money instead of Goldman Sachs, some of us might spend it on, you know, hookers and scotch. But I ask you, that's what they did with the money.
What do you think was going on out at that $500,000 party at that resort in California or the one in Arizona, both of which were thrown by AIG?
I know. I mean, really, it's a disgrace that they didn't. There weren't any.
I guess Reverbo. I guess I'm gonna. We can set some benchmarks, can't we? We know George Bush hates benchmarks, but we can set some benchmarks. Something's going to be done, I hope. And I hope it's not no strings attached. Here's a few billion. Have a nice time, boys. With Detroit, we already know what's been done with Wall Street. Here's a crazy one for you. Who spends money?
Who spends money? Yeah. Oh, this is one of those rhetorical questions.
Well, not really. It's we might be playing a little bit of Socratic dialogue, but not a lot. The crowd on Wall Street.
I could answer that though. I know who spends money. People who have money.
No, people who don't have money.
Well, but
the people who have money tend to squirrel any extra they get. That's how they got where they are. People who don't have money, if they get money, spend it. And they go buy stuff. That was the impetus behind the so-called stimulus check of a few months back.
Right.
There is one place in the American economy, and it makes extra good sense right now given what the numbers are. There's one place in the American economy where you could just pump in stimulus all day long and watch things take off.
The alcoholic beverage industry?
Sadly, it doesn't. That's not allowed within this program, but it's not a bad idea. No, the food stamp program.
Oh, yeah. For
now, there's a brand new statistic out just a week or so old. We now know that as of the end of Bushmerica, 1 in 10 Americans is food stamp dependent.
Well, what a legacy.
10%. 10% of America is on food stamps. And the food stamp allotment, we know, Reverbo, is $3 per day per person. So if you're dead-ass broke, out of work, got no job and no hope of getting a job, and the only way you're going to get fed is food stamps, you've got $90 to stretch over 30 days.
Well, that's when you head on over to those establishments where a hamburger technician will craft your lunch for you.
Yeah, but they're not working on the wimpy theory where I will gladly pay you on Tuesday for a hamburger today.
No, they're not.
They want it on the barrel head. But see, if the origins... And very few people, probably don't even think about it, but I do. The origins of what are now food stamps started in a commodities program. And the commodities program was designed not to feed hungry people, but to buy up surplus production and provide welfare to America's farmers. And then the government wound up with all this excess food, which they then said, well, we can either let it rot in the warehouse or we can give it to poor people. And that was the commodities program, administered through the United States Department of Agriculture. That transformed when Business America saw how much was being put out there, They went and they whispered lovingly in their little Congress critter's ears and said, we want some of this.
I'll bet they do.
You're just giving away cans of peanut butter and cheese and rice and beans.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and that's why you can't take a group picture of West Virginians. Every time the photographer says cheese, we form a single line. But so having thus whispered, Reverbo, the government came up with food stamps. And suddenly you were no longer lining up for the cheese and the peanut butter. You took your happy ass to the grocery store and bought the retail peanut butter and the retail cheese. And suddenly the grocery sellers were tickled spitless. And so as a consequence of that, because the food support in this country is retail based, if you put more money into the food stamp program, you know, hell's bells. We pay $29 a day to Halliburton to feed our soldiers. And we can't pay $10 a day to feed an American citizen?
You're headed down the road, you're headed to the Netherlands. You're headed to Europe. This kind of talk is all you got to do is raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, tax everybody at a 50% rate, give us all health care and send us to college for free, and just watch prosperity.
Next thing you know, you're Denmark, and you're the happiest country on earth.
Oh, everything's just hunky-dory. I know, that's exactly what they ought to do.
And, I mean, they're going to do all of this other stuff. Let's take a little nod. Let's give a little nod to the people who actually carry this country on their backs.
Well, good grief. Look at what the money that's, like your example, look at the money you're spending on welfare, all these social programs, welfare and food stamps and all of it. Just go ahead and just absorb that all into, well, I don't know. It makes too much sense.
You know, but seriously, take food stamps and triple it. So that guy who's down on his luck for a couple of months in between jobs, dead broke, damn near starving, can have $270 a month to eat on. You know, $10 a day, you can almost begin to eat nutritiously.
Almost, yeah.
If you're really, really frugal and you cook for yourself. And then that's an education issue about teaching. There's so much. Oh God, this could be the whole show, Reverbo.
No, you're back. We're back to where we started, and with that, I need to hang up. But it's Jeffersonian. You cannot have a functioning democracy without an educated electorate.
Hear, hear.
That's it, man. You got. If people would just become, we are too easily manipulated when we're stupid.
And some people like it that way.
Well, some people encourage it.
Hear,
hear. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Well, you too, and go light me a candle in front of the shrine, would you? You know, to the possum goddess.
All right, I will remind her. Well, she needs no reminding. Oh, it's interesting. Back to the real thing with John Lennon. It was so funny. Is had the possum goddess been in charge for all these centuries, and not the Pope, John Lennon would probably be a saint by now.
Well, there is that. Yes. Of course, he is. You know, him, Bill Hicks. You know, I'm putting together my own little saintly pantheon.
Yeah, there you go. All right, take it easy.
All right, later, Reverbo.
All right, make it personal.
Keep it personal.
All right, goodbye.
Bye. Doesn't get much more personal than hunger, does it? Can't do a whole lot of high-minded philosophizing with your belly rumbling. And frankly, we do need some... That thing that Guy James played weeks ago has just stayed with me. The idea of a president imploring the American people to go read the Constitution. Talk about your bully pulpit. That was a direct and proximate cause of a nation that for a generation understood the workings of its government. Because there's another study that came out, and I'm going right to the phones. Read about it in the last week. Maybe I mentioned it on the show. I'm not sure. It all runs together after a while. A kid leaving high school takes a quiz. on American civics and government, and scores in the 54th percentile. That kid then goes to college, if he or she is lucky, and takes the same quiz coming out of college and scores in the 54th percentile again. What were the last 4 years? Well, in light of the way that we treat college as glorified trade school now, there probably wasn't any time in the core curriculum for explaining what the hell the government means. That government means we the people, and that there are structures in place in which people can participate as opposed to just being wandering ciphers on the political landscape. 54%, 54% for 4 years. I got to find the link because somebody sent it to me and I took it. Not bragging, I think I scored 98%. I can't remember where I messed up. I think it was probably in the economics questions. But these are the problems that confront our country. You and I, we have meaningful discussions about what it means to be an American. You just heard one of them. Part of the reason that I think the horn is so important, he said, putting a C-clamp on his noggin to keep it from swelling. It's not me, it's you. I'm not trying to be self-aggrandizing here. Part of why this experiment is so important, though, is what lays behind everything when I say that we're trying to reinvent the American dialogue, reinvent the American discussion, reinvigorate the American debate. Because the simple fact of the matter is, we're doing this, and in doing what we're doing, these 3 hours a night, and the rest of the time on the horn, Mark Levine's hour, Guy James's 2 hours, what we're doing is a rarity. Right-wing radio, then, and let's go to Fred and Busted Knuckle. God dang it, I sure hate them immigrants. Oh, those immigrants are anti-American immigrants. You're dang right. That is not a discussion about what it means to be American. What you and I are doing is a discussion about what it means to be American. And it needs to happen on a much broader plane. And if we can ever grow this thing, it will. You know, the fact of the matter is, if I started the program every night and the phones went beep, 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 beep. Well, you've heard it. I won't leave the program at an end with people on hold. I just won't do it. I'm not married to anybody's automation system. My time is your time, and your time is precious to me. If we ever get to the point where this debate expands, by God, I'll get behind this microphone and I'll stay here 6 hours a night. I will. Because it matters that much. Especially as we move into a new administration and we, progressives, liberals, Democrats, decent human beings, are called upon to reinvent what it means to be a sovereign participant in a representative democracy. That takes discussion. That takes dialogue. That takes debate. You don't have to agree with me, and I don't have to agree with you. But we do, by God, have to talk about it. Go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. I must say I'm a little concerned. I caught what you were saying last night about the funding of the program and how some of your supporters may not be there next month. So I hope some checks started rolling in for you, or some people, you know, clicked on your donation button on your website. Like you, I agree, we very much need to do what we can to broaden the discussion, and I so enjoy your conversations with other people around the country, and I think it's a unique and precious resource. So.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you something, Preston. You just said that, and I'm not fishing. But you listen to a lot of liberal talk, liberal programming. I know you're plugged into books and films and documentaries. When I imagine Preston's world, I imagine a world where that is just surrounded with a constant inflow of information.
Well, you're right. I know I'm very lucky, very privileged that way. When I used to go to bookstores, my mom and dad were very encouraging, and they'd subsidize my interest in whatever. And I've also discovered some very unique, small publishers and independent DVD makers. And, yeah, there's a lot of incredible material going on.
Well, let me just ask you. You just said that what we're doing here is unique. I mean, do you hear anything like this out there? And then there's not a right answer.
Right. Well,
I mean, there's not, different not, people no, doing different I mean, things, but
yeah, and there are people who touch on it, but there's a form to what you do. In fact, Noam Chomsky has pointed out the tyranny of concision. And how difficult it can have to have a deep discussion if in between 2 minute segments. And
wow, what a phrase! I just wrote that down. Tyranny of concision. That's brilliant.
Okay. Yeah. And so this open format, yeah, it's unique for sure. I'm sure there's somebody who's doing something like it, but I'm not thinking of them offhand. And again, I think it would be a real shame, and you know, something we need to consider ourselves as your audience, if we do let it kind of dry on the vine. We're responsible for that. I mean, we complain a lot about, you know, where money should be going and it's not going to it. I mean, we have some disposable income ourselves, almost every one of us. So I think we need to consider where we put chunks of it.
And I don't mean to sound bitter or sour grapes or anything, but Reverbo a few minutes ago, Preston, mentioned the fact that, lo and behold, the fundraising through Obama's email list has already started again.
Yeah.
And I understand the vast amounts of money that it takes to run a political campaign, but I do worry, and not just for myself. I worry for Buzz Flash and Bart Kopp and everybody that relies on the sort of donative structure or contributory structure that has sort of developed over time. I worry about all the oxygen, and oxygen is another word for money, being sucked out of the room.
Yeah, that's an issue for sure. Do you know how much it was that he got from just the general public versus, you know, he did have some banking interests and money, but I thought it was something like 5-1 more from regular people than
that was that sort of ratio was what I saw in sort of round general terms. There were numbers out today during the campaign. Obama had about a $400 million surplus over what McCain and the Republicans had to spend.
Okay.
And you can certainly argue that grassroots campaign solicitation may well have accounted for it. Now, that was Obama, the DNC, you know, all things taken together,
mm-hmm.
versus McCain and the RNC and all those things taken together. But it was about a $400 million gap.
Okay.
And the thing that drives me the craziest, Preston, is that virtually all that money, or not virtually all, I don't know what the percentage is. I'd be lying if I said I did. But a whole bunch of that money, how's that for precision? A whole bunch of that money was paid to people who hate liberal progressive ideals. so that whether McCain won or whether Obama won, the same old crooked, broken, bought and paid for media structure made out like bandits.
Yeah. They certainly had an interest, too, in kind of sustaining the election and elongating it with all the ad revenue that was coming in, for sure.
I mean, look at the length of this political cycle, and look at the money that was made out of that length.
Yeah.
This was the most expensive American political campaign on record, was it not?
Mm-hmm. So many other countries have a drastically different approach to it.
Well, what is it, 6 weeks in the United Kingdom? But then again, the people there own their media.
Mm-hmm.
So the Beeb doesn't have a vested interest in running bajillion-dollar ads. You know, just to kind of get a feel from this, and I didn't mean to hijack your call.
No, it's okay.
With another topic. But look, here in another month and 3 weeks, it's going to be Super Bowl time. And for 2 weeks before the Super Bowl, we will have as many news stories running about what ads are going to run during the Super Bowl as there will be sports stories about the relative merits of the teams competing therein.
Yeah, and a lot of the dialogue will be about which ad was your favorite ad. You know, never which ad made you angry because it was manipulating you and your children. You know, which ad was most sexist and irrelevant and offensive to your life? No, it's which one's your favorite.
Yeah, which talking beer animal did you like best?
Yep. It was interesting. Speaking of some of the DVDs and stuff that I'm acquainted with, I used to sell the film. Actually, I still do sell the film. It's called Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky and the Media. And came out about 20 years ago from the National Film Board of Canada. Helped put a lot of money into it. It would have had a hard time finding funding here in this country,
to say the least.
Yeah. And anyway, I started selling that, and I took out little advertisements, and I made sure to target my very limited ad budget towards progressive outlets, like the Progressive Magazine and Utney Reader, stuff like that. And then people would call me and order the film, and I actually had an order from the head of Orwell Would Love This Department, Consumer Education, from Anheuser-Busch and their headquarters in St. Louis.
And you kind of got to mail it out, don't you?
Yeah.
Even though you just assumed they didn't have it.
I have mixed feelings about this, and even I thought of this as you were saying, talking about all the money spent on the right-wing media by Obama's campaign. Maybe if they're getting money from progressive sources, it will influence them in a way, you know, who knows?
I guess I'm enough of a cynic, Preston, that I say that it'll influence them as long as the progressive sources are paying more money than the conservative sources.
Yeah.
Because this is pure opportunism.
Yeah, and the way the right-wing establishment can collect and hoard, you know, so much money, you know, they're probably going to win that competition unless we find ways to get it back, you know, unless we find ways to get
well, the media but back. Sooner. Well, okay, there's a great question for discussion. If the economy goes where it looks like the economy is going, because we're not there yet. Doesn't that, by extension, have to have some impact on the media themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, are TV networks and the six companies that own what percentage of all media in the United States, are they immune from what happens on Wall Street and what happens in London and Tokyo and Hong Kong as far as global finances are concerned?
Maybe some are, some aren't. I think it depends on how connected they are to the, you know, the monarchy, I guess, or this feudal system they've got. There'll be some media outfits that will constantly have funding through something to do with democracy and education or something. And it's a total front group, you know, CIA kind of propaganda type stuff. I don't know. They'll always see money. In fact, I think Sean Hannity is very much connected with this monarchy. I think he's very much connected with elements of the FBI.
You got to wonder where he made that contact, though, because if you follow the progress of his career, it comes out of California, winds up at, you know, crappy little small market stations in North Alabama, and then you turn around one day and the sucker's on Fox.
You know, if we look at our history, like Operation Mockingbird, and people can look that up on, like, Wikipedia, it talks about how in the 70s our government investigated this rogue element of our CIA that infiltrated our media, Operation Mockingbird, to try to, you know, direct the discussion, direct the narratives of what's being talked about, who's leading the discussions, how are they being framed. You know, I don't think stuff like that has stopped. Although that was exposed and, you know, criticized, I think it continues. And I think, you know, again and again, Hannity attacks Obama as the Messiah. Now, there's a history to that attack, that specific attack, that use of that language, the Messiah. It was in FBI documents when they were writing about Martin Luther King and what they're going to do to try to defame him and discredit him and ridicule him. Hannity is repeating the same attacks. How does he get money? He's not, you know, they start to run this promo for him. The voice of the people, Sean Hannity.
God, you do that way too well. Oh.
And they're doing it because they know it's exactly the opposite. He's a voice of the small group of people who get their money through all sorts of unfree markets. And, yeah, they're always going to have outlets. But other parts of the media will suffer or will be closed down. We just had the Rocky Mountain News here be put up for sale.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we had, you know, we were one of the few remaining two paper towns. And, you know, with all its flaws, they're both, you know, they both became, you know, they're both corporate subsidized and everything. But still, you know, Rocky Mountain News had a pretty open letters to the editor section. They had good people. It's not monolithic. They did have good people doing some good work. I couldn't stand their editorial opinion section, which included, you know, one of the big right-wing radio hosts and their right-wing opinion editor and all that. But some reporters were doing good work. So who knows? Maybe Rupert Murdoch will come in and do his thing with it, which would be terrible, but that's a possibility. Again, Murdoch will seem to always have money, you know, people like that.
And I guess that speaks to the fact that his empire is so diverse that there's always somewhere that'll make him a buck. If we go in the tank, he's, you know, it's like Bogart looking at Ingrid Bergman and saying, we'll always have Paris. You know, Murdoch will always have Australia.
Yeah.
Or London.
Yeah. And, you know, people like Murdoch, again, I certainly don't like a lot of what he's about, but I don't want to caricature him totally.
I've read some very interesting the pieces about him and a couple of limited interviews, and this gossip that's coming out that he spits on the ground at the mere mention of the name of Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course O'Reilly announced that he's pulling, and everybody knew it beforehand, but it's official now that he's pulling the plug on his stupid little radio show.
Yeah.
So who will they promote into that slot? It ain't going to be a liberal. I don't know. Then again, I don't know. Maybe it's going to be Alan Colmes.
I was just going to say, I hope it's Alan Colmes. Although he has a radio show already.
But if they put the force behind it that was put behind O'Reilly, mm-hmm. it's a very different radio show.
I'd like to see that. You know, as I've mentioned before, I think he's. He gets more credit than he receives sometimes. And, again, another very open forum. And again, it brings up that issue of his audience and what's their responsibility. You know, a lot of progressives are simply AWOL when it comes to media activism. I'm not sure what it is, a combination of fear of public speaking, fear of maybe getting on some list, you know.
How about two generations worth of inculcated passivity and sheepish behavior?
Yep, there you go. There you go. Learning how to be spectators, always just spectating instead of being on the field.
And that's the difference that we talk about here so much, Preston, that idea that if you're doing liberal conversation, if you're doing progressive conversation, you cannot do what the right wing does and expect to succeed. You can't get behind the microphone or talk to people on the phone over the air and deliver marching orders. You have to think this way. You can't do that. We aren't that way.
Yeah. You know, that's another way where this is totally unique, this forum. It can go in any direction, you know. Other forums, it's kind of stay here. Stay here.
Look, I mean, it is a fact, and I'm not naming names or telling tales out of school or anything, but there is this philosophy within so-called talk radio that the job of the audience is to talk about what the host brings to the table.
Yeah.
And so just by example, Preston, this isn't too much inside baseball, I hope. You know, I'm sitting here looking at a telephone system that's got 6 lines. Well, for another couple of grand, I can add one that's got 12. And what you've got is you've got a little phone screener, and he picks up the phone and says, what's your name and what's your topic? And your name and your topic goes down. And if you're not on topic, you're not going on.
Yep.
But I frankly find that just in terms of my taste, mind you, in terms of my taste and my taste only, I don't like that. I like the challenge that I get from wondering what's going to happen when I press the next button. You know, to go from, like last night, this beautiful little thing, this little flower that blossomed, that turned out, it started out sounding like a sports conversation, but it wound up being a very profound conversation about economics, and we hadn't touched on it. And it's just what happened when I pressed the button. Now that keeps me honest, it keeps me on my toes, and I think and I hope, and it seems from the correspondence that I get, that it's something that people respond to. And it's how it, because I never did see conversation as linear. Because right. anybody who's ever, I don't know about you and yours, but most of the places I've ever lived, the central gathering point is not the living room in the home, it's the kitchen. And the conversations that take place in the kitchen are punctuated with, hand me the vanilla, would you? And give me a potholder. And that'll lead you off in different directions. And I love that stuff.
Right. Versus, you do see how we've been trained, though, sometimes to have this linear follow-the-leader discussion. And, you know, in the absence of liberals calling into a program like Alan's, he'd be flooded with these kind of, you know, trained seals of Hannity's, Hannitized ditto heads. And you'd know what they were going to say. You even knew their tone. It was going to be the same snarky tone, attack, 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 attack.
Why do you hate America?
Right. Over and over again, and it was sad to witness. And again, it gave the whole audience a misperception of thought in this country. You know, people would listen to this and come to think, well, gee, it's such a conservative country. I mean, listen to these callers. This is America. And they represented us in a way that I think is not accurate, and it's a perversion of the national character in many ways.
Well, it's not how the nation got started. If you remember the habits and the lifestyles of the people who wrote the Declaration of Independence and framed the Constitution, among other things, not that I'm praising abuse of anything or any substances, those guys drank up to a gallon of wine a day. And many of them sort of got a bump along the way with a little snort out of a laudanum bottle.
Yeah. Ben Franklin said something about beer is proof that God likes man or something like that. But certainly that would be that would punctuate a lot of their discussions. I'm going to get another beer or another smoke or something.
Yeah. And so you just know by virtue of if you've ever been in one of those conversations, those weren't linear conversations. Those were webbish conversations. They were all over the place. And imagine the debate over slavery. No sober person comes up with the 3/5 of a human being, the rationale, without help.
Right, right.
So it strikes me. Look, the conversation as it's laid out is laid out the way it is, at least on radio, for a very good reason. And that is, what's most important in terrestrial radio is getting to the next commercial break.
Right.
And so your topic will fit into the commercial, and we'll get you to the next commercial break on the back of somebody who really called in and had something to say, but got cut off after 30 seconds because it's time to sell more beer.
Yeah. And then a lot of weather and sports breaks and traffic, which, you know, you can debate the necessity of, or I don't know, the frequency seems a little overdone, but those breaks as well, the news.
Oh, I used to marvel at the fact that there are still small market stations whose salespeople go out and sell the weather. This weather brought to you by Fred's Drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
Fred's Drugstore, when it's raining outside.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? But they do that because everything is analyzed not in terms of the value that it brings to the charge, which is to serve the public interest and the public good. It's not analyzed in those terms. It's analyzed in terms of, can we sell this?
Right, right. You know, and speaking of the traffic breaks, I mean, it is important to know, if there's some big traffic jam someplace and you can avoid it, I guess.
If you're in a hurry, sure.
Yeah, yeah. But, the accidents are they're covered kind of strangely. It's like, I don't know, you just kind of hear about the accident, but you never hear about really what happened to any of these people and or many of the details. I don't know, it's covered in a kind of inuring kind of way, or depersonalizing these tragedies that we're hearing about day after day after day. And I think stuff like that, really looking at, you know, just the fragility of life in so many ways. You could be killed when you go out on the roads, but we don't let it paralyze us. You know, we're not paralyzed by fear. You know,
you are at more hazard on an inner city American roadway than anything that Osama bin Laden could ever cook up in his twisted little mind. You just are.
Right. And also, you know, I kind of think about, you know, I don't want to belittle people's concerns about maybe, you know, some of the blowback from political engagement. You know, you might get on a list or something like that. But again, you know, terrible things can happen in whatever we do.
But if you get on a list over the conversations we have on this program and the other ones on the horn, Preston, then the fault is not that of the commentator. The fault is that of the people who make the list who think that this is dangerous.
Right, right. And hopefully some of those people making the list, they're just kind of bureaucrats, and they're just, you know, this is what, you know, make some list of people who call this show. Okay, whatever. And they do, whatever. And, you know, I mean, it was a badge of honor to be, like, on Nixon's enemies list. You know, if you weren't there, people...
That was the one thing in his life Paul Newman was said to be proudest of.
Oh, great. That's great.
He and I read a commentary in the New York Times from Dick Cavett saying that he and Mr. Newman had both agreed in convivial terms that since they were both on Nixon's enemies list, they both had something to be plenty proud of. You know, looking back in history, who has the better reputation, the people who were on his friends list or on his enemies list? Look at how many problems we've had in the last 8 years because of people who were on Nixon's friends list. You know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, you know, sitting there in their sock feet, at the feet of the master. Tell us another story of corruption, Uncle Dick. Because they literally were. They cut their teeth on Nixonian fraud and political chicanery and outright evil.
Yep, and look how close he was to, say, J. Edgar Hoover, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the whole hit, you know, going backwards, you know, there sits Richard Nixon on HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody thinks of the witch hunt in terms of the McCarthy, but daggum, Richard Nixon was a huge hunk of that. You know, the only people who were more conservative than Richard Nixon were the John Birchers. And they thought he was a commie.
Yeah. And boy, our history of how, like, the Socialist Workers' Party, you know, they came down on, the establishment came down on the big time. And they're still, you know, kind of suffering from it, I think, you know?
Oh, without a doubt. And, you know, I've been really impressed by this sort of serendipitous happenstance that I had of running into this political theory of the Overton window. And I realize that there have to be people out there, having studied this, there have to be people out there who are far more radical than I.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're on the far end of the rope, the same rope that I'm pulling on.
Mm-hmm.
In the same direction.
Yeah, but I guess there was, like, the Pinkerton raids, and their offices would get raided, and their files taken, and stuff like that. And then, you know, people have been kind of driven into the closet almost, you know, ashamed to call themselves a socialist, and just that constant use of the term, socialist this and socialist that, Obama's such a socialist.
It's because the other side is so scared of the term, because the other side recognizes
potency of it.
Well, the potency of it, but the desirability of it. If you let America have an honest conversation about things like health care, and these things are reflected in polling data all across the country, you'll find that most people would like to stop having the health care debate and just have health care taken care of once and for all. And the answer to that is universal single-payer health care.
Yeah, and in defense of the Obama administration, certainly there have been a lot of disappointments, but I was glad to see Tom Daschle use the phrase universal health care recently at some press conference, make a call for it. So, you know, probably won't take the form, you know, that most of us would like to see, but still, he's pushing the concept. Actually, speaking of universal things, we're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well.
Which we're still not real good at, We could use a little focus and a little work on acknowledging what all that means. And of course, the Vatican. I don't know if you saw this the other day. The Vatican got its knickers in a twist over a UN resolution that would call upon all the countries of the world to decriminalize homosexuality. Now, see, that makes my head hurt. Just a phrase like decriminalize homosexuality, because it presupposes backward, benighted, sad, terrified little cultures in which what your sexuality is in some cases cause for execution. And the Vatican stepped in and said, no, no, no. Wow.
So,
so glad they're out there advocating for the positions of the Prince of Peace.
I actually just saw a documentary on some of the past gay rights struggles and how sometimes women and men were institutionalized. If someone found out they were gay, a family member, and institutionalized them for several months until they came out right, you know. You know, there's still certainly all kinds of abuses, but still generally people don't accept that kind of thing. So there's been progress regarding gays and their liberation, but socialists definitely have some work to do, or just reclaiming that concept. I know people,
but it can be done, Preston, because the word liberal has become much less toxic than it was in the last couple of decades.
Definitely.
Because people have seen what passes for conservatism, and it's gotten to the point that it makes the gorge rise in the back of their throats.
On top of that, the right-wing ideologues have had to try to deal with this other concept, progressive. I mean, that hardly existed a few years ago over national airwaves, but now here it is. And, you know, it becomes this different kind of concept that people can identify with that isn't, you know, so-called conservative. That's another thing about Hannity. He's always going on about his conservative values, his conservative principles, and I'll repeat the values, principles again and again and again.
But never gets around to really enunciating what they are, does he?
Nope. And he's simply branding himself because he can't say what he really is.
There you go. Marketing and advertising.
Mm-hmm. You know, neo-fascist still isn't popular, but that's essentially his agenda. And back quickly to the kind of the linear thinking, the Hannitized people, I wanted to read something real quick from Rudolf Rocker, who was an anarchist philosopher. Another term that's been purposely obscured, made negative, and again, because of the threat of it, I think. And Rudolf Rocker, he was writing in the mid-1930s. He recently left Germany, saw kind of what was coming down. And he wrote a book called Nationalism and Culture. And he says, the history of the state is the history of human oppression and intellectual disenfranchisement. It is the story of the unlimited lust for power of small minorities, which could be satisfied only by the enslavement and exploitation of the people. The deeper the state, with its countless agencies, penetrates into the spheres of activity of social life, the more its leaders succeed in changing men into mindless automatons of their will. So,
and the people who are doing that are scared to death that people might actually start hearing those words.
Yep.
Well, it reminds me of Emma Goldman. Even in the portrayal that's made of her in Warren Beatty's movie Reds, it's clear that, you know, she said all along, I'm an anarchist.
Yep.
And yet, that if you read what she, if you, and I, you know, when I was a kid, and I saw that movie in the theaters, or a young man, it made me want to go out and read about these people. You know, I sat down, read me some Eugene O'Neill plays, and I read Jack Reed's book, and I read some Emma Goldman. And I didn't, you know, I didn't see anything in Emma Goldman about setting the world on fire. I saw in her writings a real compassion for working, struggling humanity.
Yeah, maybe setting the world on fire, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, but...
And, you know, it was interesting how she was able to integrate herself into so many different, you know, elements of our society. I mean, a lot of wealthy people didn't want her around and wanted her deported, which she eventually was. Didn't she come back, though?
Came back and went... Did she die abroad? I think she did.
I forget. I'm going to have to Wikipedia her.
But it's fascinating because she was not only disillusioned with the United States, she went over and had a nice long look at the Bolshevik Revolution happening there and was equally disenchanted with that.
Yeah. She used to speak at one of their public forums back in the day before radio. They had these chautauquas.
Yes.
Okay. And there's like two official Chautauquas still remaining. There's one in Boulder and I guess also in New York State. But there used to be like a couple hundred or more of these.
Oh, in its day, it was the political equivalent of vaudeville.
That's right.
I mean, I mean no disrespect in either comparison, but there was a circuit.
Yeah. But, and so your listeners know, Chautauquas were basically people would come and speak in lectures on politics and science, and there would also be performances of music and plays, and everybody welcome.
I guess I'm just an old-fashioned geek, but I love the thought of something like that.
Teddy Roosevelt called Chautauqua one of the most American things about America. So, yeah, and they, you know, people still attempt them at times. I mean, some of these green festivals going on, I think, are very much in that tradition, and Jim Hightower was involved with some kind of Rolling Thunder tour.
Right.
You know, and Madison, Wisconsin, each year they have a Fighting Bob.
The Fighting Bob Festival, sure.
Okay.
And you know, Lord, wouldn't I love to take this out on that kind of a road?
I was just going to say that, too. I was just going to say that. Again, the potential for this is so huge, and I really hope people invest in that. You know, there just seems to be a missing link going on, a missing linkages, where, you know, your financial issues could be resolved, and other people, you know, activists out there, organizations that need a platform to express their concerns and their visions for something better, they could have that resolved when they connect with programs like this. And why that is not happening, that's the great mystery. That is the great mystery to me. That training and competition, maybe, our distrust, our cynicism that grows in us, the loss of notions of solidarity or networking, I don't know.
And well, and don't forget the absence of money, because most of the groups that you're talking about don't have a lot of it,
yeah.
And count every, because on our side, as we have, I think it was Joe Vecchio who first jokingly noted this. On our side, what happens is if you do get some sort of funding, you get a demand for a strict accounting of every staple stapled.
Right.
Where the right wing goes out there and says, here's a couple $1 million. Call us if you need another.
Right. And enjoy yourself at some Ruth's Chris Steakhouse while you're at it or whatever.
Right. And, you know? I mean, there are realities out there. The other thing that plays into it is cronyism. And probably the monument that was built to that is in something out there that was called Greenstone Media. You may remember that. It was going to be a women's alternative to talk radio, and I'm not trying to be demeaning. I'm not trying to be degrading. I think you know me better than that. But a bunch of women who had lots of money jumped on the idea because it was a good idea. But then they took the money and decided they were going to operate on the same old tired model, went out and got themselves a brick-and-mortar building, went out and hired themselves a bunch of executives, and then went about the business of trying to create radio programs.
Mm-hmm.
That's so, not how it works.
Mm-hmm. So there's absence of money and mis-expenditures of money.
And cronyism.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you don't know somebody, if you're not playing some sort of political 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you know, because the thing that happens with a program like this or virtually any other, you know, the Young Turks too, you've got to build an audience first, and you know, I got to find another word for audience because I really hate that. But you've got to build a base of people sharing their time with you. And you can't necessarily make a judgment on the first listen. You've got to be there and you've got to stick with it for a little while. And then you realize why you're coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, inside baseball again, Preston. Back in the day when I was just doing DJ stuff, I would try to get another job. Emma Goldman died in Toronto, Canada, by the way. I'd go for a new job, a better job, and you had to have something called an air check. And that's where you put together 3.5 minutes of your absolute best work that, you know, at 10 second pops. You can't put together an air check of what happens on the horn. Good God, it takes me 15 minutes to say my name. And, you know, maybe that's the knock on me. Maybe that's why I'll never succeed inside some sort of traditional terrestrial, commercial driven structure. But neither can these ideas.
Yeah, yeah. We have a community radio station here in Colorado, and they do an hour-long call-in segment. And sometimes sometimes I feel like, you know, boy, they're just getting started. And the hosts feel that way. You know, they're just kind of getting started exploring some topic. And, you know, the callers are starting to get, you know, their own thoughts developed to contribute to the subject.
And then it's time to turn it off.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And so, you know, what I was saying about the structure and not being able to function in it, somebody in a traditional broadcast medium, or somebody who is very busy, you know, one of the movers and shakers, they don't have 10 days. Or they don't have a week to sit down and tune in at, you know, or to even podcast every day, because they not only don't have 3 hours, they don't have 30 minutes, they don't have 15. So they'll judge you, you know, whether it's me or anybody else, they'll make the judgment on what they hear in literally 15 seconds. And you cannot subject this kind of conversation to that kind of analysis. You just can't.
Yep. It necessitates oversimplification. And
it also creates reasons to reject, because they're not looking to say yes, they're looking to say no. That's why that whole advertising marketing book that was put out a few years back, decades maybe, called Getting to Yes. You ever heard of that?
Yeah.
And it's all about how to get people past their native unwillingness to be had.
Yeah, I recognize a lot of the rhetorical techniques from right-wing talk from sales books I used to have to read.
Sure, and in the bad old days when I was a telemarketer, and sadly quite good at it, one of the things that was constantly taught to the newbies coming in was that you ask leading questions in the course of your pitch. You don't say, "Hi, you want a credit card?" No, that's the answer. No. Instead, you ask, "Sure would be great to have a new credit card with a lot more services attached to it, wouldn't it?"
There you go.
Where the answer has to be yes.
Yep. Exactly.
And the higher the quanta of yes that you achieve, the more likely it is that you're going to close the deal on the downside of the curve.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, you know, and I try not to do the leading question thing, because leading questions are kind of dirty. That means you're not interested in what the other party has to say, and it's awfully handy in a courtroom setting, but it's not worth a darn inside any sort of inquiry that's genuinely interested in a non-biased outcome. So that if you catch somebody asking leading questions outside a court or political hearing sort of judicial situation, you know that they've got something to hide.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Back to the Chautauqua thing.
Sure.
And these kind of progressive traditions of this country that we sometimes lose sight of. And actually, I just came upon a book. You know, a lot of media material, like, you know, I could never afford everything I'd like, but I discover it through Amazon's website. And I love reading people's reviews of stuff, but I just stumbled upon a book recently, something called, I think, The Hoe and the Hammer, Alabama Communists in, like, 1900 to 1930 or something like that. And the communist tradition, you know, again, that word's been made, has been identified with, you know, Stalinist tyranny and gulags, but the other parts of the communist story are left out. And this one about agrarian people in Alabama, and they had a lot to do with the civil rights movement coming about. And instead of being ridiculed and never allowed to exist or be spoken of in polite company, these traditions should be honored. And so along with communists in Alabama, and I mean, and what are they saying? Again, the stench of big government was the headline of that email you got.
Yeah.
How many of these people with this sort of anti-government attitude get their checks from the government every couple of weeks? Or,
oh, sure.
You know, maybe they're in the military, maybe they're in the NSA, maybe they work for Lockheed Martin. And Northrop Grumman, I saw, they're getting a big $40 million contract for doing something with the new high-tech militarized wall between the U.S. and Mexico. that again, most of the people who will become illegal people will be flying over that fence and just overstaying visas. That's what 60% of undocumented people do. They simply overstay their visas. So just pour money into this wall. You know, again, something we always have, there's always eternal funds for certain ugly media projects and certain ugly infrastructure projects, you know, to create this children of men dystopia. There's always money for that kind of big government. But solar panels and windmills, what? Oh, no, we got to tighten our belts.
No, that's, because, no, that's, yeah. That's toxic big government. Right. Right.
Right. But,
you mentioned solar panels and windmills. Another email, not from a right-winger that I got today, but more from the sane left, came came with a pitch. They all do. From the Apollo Alliance, an organization that I have a profound degree of respect for, but pointing out the fact that good old Senator Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, whom Bart Kopp refers to as Pisquick, is doing everything in his power, along with his ilk and his cronies, to stop what Obama has mentioned as having a clean energy, good job bill ready the day he takes office. And Inhofe is going. Inhofe is sitting there in the Senate saying, "Oh no, we're not going to do that because you know we done got all married up to the hydrocarbon industry, and we're not going to let you divorce us, no matter how toxic our relationship is for the rest of y'all." So
it's tyrannical. I mean, the recent Antonio Yuhal's book, something about the oil tyranny, you know, the biggest tyranny in the world, the oil industry and what we can do about it.
But yet, by comparison, and this is something I've been thinking about ever since the news came down, this wonderful news that Bank of America is going to phase out its support for funding of mountaintop removal operations.
Great.
And I can't help but think, you know, we have advocated for these things for so long, and we have begged our elected representatives for so long, and lo and behold, it's the big money who may make the change.
It will be a combination, you know, big money being influenced by lots of individual actions, both within the system, very much within the system, and without as well. You know, it's, you know, what Robert Kennedy is doing on his show. And in his speaking engagements and the book he wrote, Crimes Against Nature, it's the students protesting, you know, outside of these banks.
Yes. And when it becomes unprofitable, and frankly, because of the crisis that has struck the financial sector, organizations like Bank of America have to take a second look at business models like that of Massey Energy, because Massey Energy is not a good investment. Because at the very least, what Massey Energy does is use a highly destructive, incredible liability generating method to create the revenues with which they service their debt.
Yeah.
And frankly, they're servicing that debt on a very narrow margin. And as Massey's got $225 million worth of judgment that they were just told to pay by the United States Supreme Court.
Great.
I'd think twice if I was Citi or Bank of America or any of that crowd too.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, likewise, the nuclear industry. If that's going to have a renaissance, yeah, it's going to be like 100% government funded, because private investors don't want to get into it. But we'll see, and it will be very profitable, though, for some people on the receiving end of the checks, you know, and it will be, you know, put the country deeper in debt, and certainly it will put the environment deeper in debt. And again, when people get to a point where, you know, it really bothers them that in the 70s, women got breast cancer, you know, 1 in 11 women got breast cancer, now it's 1 in 7. When people really feel that in their bones, they'll start demanding that their money goes to other sorts of investments, you know, less toxic stuff.
And I think there are probably economic models along those lines. Preston, this has been a wonderful conversation. There's a couple of lights blinking here that I hope are still people.
Yeah.
But have yourself a wonderful weekend. And by the way, Frank and Angel in the chat room has asked me to ask you if you've gotten a chance to look at the flyer.
I'm kind of embarrassed, but I wasn't able to open the attachment. But I was going to certainly email her back and thank her for the effort. She's going to mail me, actually, a couple copies because I don't have a printer anyway. So she's going to send me some copies to photocopy. And, yeah, I look forward to checking it out and thank her so much for the work. And yeah, it'll be fun letting other people know about the Head On Radio Network. And before I let you go, I also wanted to let you know of a book called Progressive Nation, a travel guide with 400-plus inspiring landmarks and left turns. And, I think if we can remember our history, which in many ways is progressive, we can envision a future, that can be progressive as well in some ways.
Absolutely. And, the people who made this nation weren't exactly sitting around. Well, if they'd been conservative, there wouldn't have been a revolution because those were the Tories, and we know how that all works out. Exactly. Preston, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you for everything you brought to the table.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
In Denver, our buddy Preston, and let's see if anybody is still there. Nope, not there. All right, let's try this. Nope. You're not going to do this to me, are you? Hey, welcome to the program.
I'm still here.
Hot dog, Ed. I'm glad you are.
It's one of the conversations. I could listen to that until I got sleepy.
Well, hopefully that wouldn't happen too quick. I mean, that's not...
It is. As long as it's like that and you're learning something, that'll keep you awake. That's better than playing poker. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, have you seen the latest where they're taking Obama to court?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, my. Oh.
I don't know all there is about that, but I just noticed them running it back, by. I don't know.
This is quite this is the same kind of phony baloney thinking that engendered Whitewater in the 1990s. You'll recall that we spent $70 million investigating Bill Clinton over a busted land deal that netted nothing.
Yeah.
And here you've got a bunch of absolutely spastic, bizarre right-wingers. Why can't we see a real birth certificate? We want to see the birth certificate that the doctor actually wrote.
That is. The thing of it is, if what they're saying is accurate, would be true, the people have spoken, and I don't see what...
But wait, you're talking about a right-wing Supreme Court, Ed. The people spoke in 2000, and we got George Bush no matter what we said.
Yeah. Well, it's scary that the people's vote can be challenged by the minority. And I just thought I'd mention that to you, but that's not, I have two or three topics to talk to you about.
Go right ahead.
I think. And, they won't be as deep as what your last caller was, but that was very informative, both of you. But I wanted to tell you, you're talking about coal. And it never be clean. It's worse than that, Bob. I really believe that a lot of new diseases, a lot of new health problems in general is created by the buried germs and the stuff over thousands of years that is underground. And when they dig into these places, especially surface, that they re-expose the people to stuff that's been cured years ago, and we'll bring it back. And the thing about coal and our rivers, I've absolutely in New River, all back in the 60s, pike disappeared out of New River. Now, I can't say that coal done that. But something killed out all of the pike. I've caught pike in New River. I know what I'm talking about. But I've absolutely seen coal dirt. Now, as long as that's moving, you don't notice it, as long as it's in moving water. But in these backup eddies, backup holes or whatever you want to call them, I've seen coal dust laying on top of that river. And then they come along with these sludge ponds or whatever you want to call them, nothing but potential killers. And it's very disturbing that West Virginia and people like that's on the morning show here support coal and support the deterioration of the environment to the point to where it can only be ignorance. You know, certainly to say stuff like that, they don't know any better, or do they?
No, they it's typical. It's typical kidnap victim hostage behavior, Ed. This is what we have been told. West Virginia has been told for over 100 years now that we can't hope for any better. How many generations in those 100 years? 5? 6?
Yeah.
Imagine what happens to a people when they're beaten over the head for 6 generations with nothing but the idea that this is as good as it gets, and it's not going to get any better, and what's more, you don't deserve any better.
Well, my dad was killed by coal dust, and when you put up lives, try to balance them against the dangers and the hazards of anything in nature, I don't know where your brain is. I don't know if you got one, because, you know, life is more important than any of the resources that we've got. And unless they can show where that it can be at least 95% clean, and they're not going to get that out of coal.
Well, they can't. Even if they succeed at that, Ed, where the burning of and the preparation of the coal is concerned, they can never achieve it simply because there is no clean way to extract it from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There just isn't. This has been sort of a theme I've been working for the last 2 or 3 nights, marketing and advertising. And what we started the program with Reverbo asking about clean coal, and I said it's not a technology, it's an advertising slogan. You can see the coal, you know, the coal mafia out there advertising that coal is our most abundant energy, abundant fuel, our most abundant energy source.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out there so frequently and with such it's ubiquitous now. Oh, we've got more coal than we got oil. We got more coal than we got gas. We got more coal than we got oil and gas together. Coal must be our most abundant energy source. That,
yeah,
you just sort of go by. Even some of us who are tuned into environmental issues, and environmental issues are, of course, human issues, you just kind of slide by it. And then you have to come back and go, wait a minute, what did I just see? Coal's our most abundant fuel? And, you know, you want to grab one of these puzzle-gutted the coal executives by the throat and drag him over and take the back of his head and point it at the sky at about noon and say, you see that bright, shiny thingy up in the sky? That one that's making you see spots right now? That's called the sun. And that's our most abundant energy supply.
Mm.
And then you let him nod his little head back and start rubbing his eyes and getting the spots out. And, you know, if you're standing on a hilltop in West Virginia, you look at him and you say, and that thing that you can't see right now, but right now it's making you feel a little bit cooler from where the bright, shiny thingy up in the sky is making you feel all warm, you little coal executive, that's called the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And that can power homes without ever having to blow up a single mountain or make a single worker cough blood and phlegm into his handkerchief or make even one widow follow her minor husband's coffin to a cold, grim grave. Those are our most abundant energy sources.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to preach, Ed.
Hey, you're doing good. But it, and that's besides the many deaths that's already occurred in the coal mines. That's, I mean, outright deaths by slate fall machinery and so forth. That's not counting that.
Yeah.
But you know what the main part of that is? That it don't seem like that they should have the right to kill off the rest of the world for their greed. Now, if it was just a few people that wanted to go in the mines, knowing all the hazards that's there, and then get killed that way, I have really less concern for that than I do with them tying my hands behind me and slapping me in the face with their filth and the garbage that they're putting in the air and in the rivers, in our waters, and...
Well, exactly, Ed, because if you choose to go into that occupation, you have, well, now you can't even say you've done it as a free will, as an act of free will, because if you're in a mono economy like what West Virginia has, you know, nothing but coal or something impacted by coal, then if you want to stay here, you don't have much choice.
Yeah. Well.
So even that is compromised, but you're so right. If you do make the choice and you make it knowingly with full understanding of what the consequences are, well, I guess that's a choice for you to make. But you know what? What little baby born, and I'm sure there were several born in West Virginia today, what little baby born in West Virginia today chose to be born 10 points dumber by IQ measurement than that child would have been had there not been a bunch of coal-created mercury that had found its way into its mama's body? What? Where did that baby get to make that choice?
Yeah, and not only that, nothing's been done to stop that. But that same mercury you're talking about, where Clinton closed the factory down that was creating so much mercury in the air. And then our real smart president, George Bush, had it open back up. That's where it all comes back to, is people like him, that the ones that are less smart will put in office because of the propaganda that goes with them. And that is mind-boggling to me, that people... tell you that a hot stove ain't hot, go ahead and touch it, and they put them in office. But I'll get off of coal, and I'm going to get on to the union busting tactics that's taking place now. And I heard you mention how long the UAW had been in existence. They were one of the first industrialized progressive unions back when Walter Reuther and guys like that were heading it up. Now, it's not much better than some of the other ones now. And whether all of it is, what a lot of it is contributed to, or the contributor to it, I don't know. But I do know that we got a bunch of drunks running it. And I'm telling you, when I went to their seminars and so forth like that, the first thing you opened up the door and went in, you had a bar about 25 foot long, and there was every kind of drink that you could drink. That don't mean you had to drink it, but it become a way of life with our leaders in the UAW. And, you know, quite frankly, and to put it bluntly, UAW has gone to hell, too. But it does still represent something, and it represents the fact that they got a right to arbitration, they got a right for their cases to be heard, but they are weak compared to what they used to be. And I'm talking about, I was in it in the 60s, and I know what I'm talking about, and I know what it was, and I know what the concept was. And I adjusted to that without adjusting. I mean, it was a natural way of life for me once I saw what it was. But you got these old District 50s, or some of them's called steel workers. I'm not talking about U.S. steel workers. I'm talking about there's another union called steel workers that are around these hospitals And like that, Bob, they're not fit to be called a union. They're a useless, but they have got the, you know, seniority rights, and I've got a contract here by one. My wife works under one of them, and they've got a split thing like they have at Kroger's, food store workers, where the new hires don't get and can't reach the maximum of the older ones. And do you know what that does? That the management can sit back with their feet on the desk and watch the union deteriorate because one worker is pitted against the other. And it is a, you know, and I talked to my wife about it. I said, you know, talk to the younger ones and demand. I said, especially since the turnover at that hospital is like it is, and demand that the union go in and come up with equality with the older ones there. And I'm sure she will. You know, I'm sure that that's in a, because she's one of them. She went in after the strike was over and it looked like it was on pretty solid ground. She went in and she was told when she was hired what all the RNs had and so forth, but they don't have it. I'm telling you, there's a big difference, a big gap between those people that I call the haves and the have-nots. And I'm sure that with the new group coming in and so forth, if they believe in the union, then show it. Show that the unity is in equality. So that's my spiel on that. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, no, I think you've said a whole bunch in a very short amount of time, because those multi-tiered systems are a means of getting at union busting that they can't get at otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it remains because the protections for unions in this country are so weak, and they are. You know, things like Taft-Hartley, the administrative regulations that are promulgated by the U.S. Department of Labor. None of those are geared toward making it easier to organize. They're geared toward making it harder. And then once you get in there, the company starts working in terms of trying to bust you from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not because breaking the union makes a better product, not because breaking the union makes for a more productive workforce, but because breaking the union makes life better for management on a very short term, though.
Yeah. Well, they have nothing to stand in their way of doing everything their way without consideration for the workers' health, without the consideration of sharing in the profit. That is if the union is worth a crap, because you've got some out there that not fit to be called a union. They don't even have, they've got these clauses in the contract that you have the right to job bid. All right, then they got a little thing at the end of it says the company has the right to pick the ones that has the most qualifications. Well, that right there dumps your right, your seniority rights right down the drain as far as being able to get that job that you bid on, because if there's one there that kisses butt or something that bid on that job, then they got more qualifications. And that's the way the promotions go. I've seen it all. I've seen about everything I could throw at you in that stuff.
Well,
I'm gonna get off a union and tell you an argument I heard this morning. That America is the greatest. America is not. American economy is still sound. Other countries love us and respect us. They had a guy come on the program, particular program I'm talking about. He just got back from 3 years tour of duty somewhere and talk about when they wanted change for money, that they called it monkey money. And that the guy spit on the ground when he told, you know, when he told him he was from America. And you know what? That's another sign of where the Republicans' head is.
Well, we just brought whatever that nation is where the fellow spit on the ground, Ed. We just probably need to bomb them a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they don't see the facts, do they? They think that them people that do that are the ones that's nuts. I mean, these Republicans and these ultra-conservatives think that we're still the nation that we were back in the 50s and 60s. But we're not. We're not. We don't have... Bob, when I hit Cairns, France, and Glasgow, Scotland, coming across the circle, the red carpet was rolled out for our ship there. But I bet you now that you go there, and it'd be like that fellow was talking, they don't have a bit of use for us, justifiably. You know, they do not have, they were talking about, I think it was Sweden, because they turned down help to the auto executives. They were talking about, that's what brought up the subject that I'm on. And you never heard such a bunch, you know, three or four callers calling in. We're still the greatest nation on earth.
Yeah, as long as they say it, it's bound to be so.
Yeah, and that's what I like about a Republican, is they're always right, and they're always telling you what to do, and there ain't no other way but their way. And the other part of it, I think I mentioned it before, is they are talking and questioning Obama and his group now after George Bush has taken us all the way to the bottom. Pardon me. How can anybody else take us lower than what George Bush has taken? And, of course, O'Brien, the jerk that's in charge, that cuts you off and does what you were talking about a while ago, I'm telling you, I'm at a loss for words with disgust for people who are that ignorant. No global warming. You know, it's commerce first and people second. But I don't think we're number one, and that don't mean that I wouldn't still do what I had to do to fight and protect the country. But that means that we are not in the best of position with other countries. And you know, the very fact of not participating in this war and helping, if you call that helping, not sending their people over to be killed, shows that they're not for the Bush policies.
Well, lest we forget, literally, at the same time that all the Republicans and all the right-wingers were pouring their French wine in the gutter and changing the name of French fries in the congressional cafeteria to Freedom Fries and French toast to Freedom Toast. At the same time they were doing that, there were Frenchmen laying their lives on the line with us as our NATO allies in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
It was the fact that they had the common sense to recognize that Iraq was a daggum nightmare, not that Afghanistan isn't, but that it was a bigger nightmare, and they wanted no part of it because they knew that it was all ginned up and dummied up and faked up, and it was garbage. And what drove the right-wingers and the Republicans crazy, Ed, was the fact that they did do that, and they were pulling, you know, they were pulling the curtain back on a pretty dirty operation, on an extremely dirty operation, on an operation that would have gotten, that had, if we had any kind of responsibility in Congress, would have gotten a president impeached.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they could have done it or not. They had plenty of grounds, but I don't know if it would have ever floated. I mean, they had enough, I think, to impeach Clinton, but and you know, completely get rid of him, I think.
Well, no, they had, you know, what they had on Bill Clinton was they had enough to impeach Bill Clinton because they said they had enough to impeach Bill
yeah.
Clinton. If there hadn't have been Monica Lewinsky, there would have been something else. That was what they were going to do. In other words, they started off with a result, and they started off with an end, and then they worked on the means.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, Obama, the way it's starting off before he's ever even in office, is certainly going to have a long, long row to hoe. You know, his row to hoe is going to be long enough with economics, the war, and stuff like that, let alone some of these damned idiots on their, well, I don't mean to insult the idiots again, but the fact that he has got enough on his shoulders the way it is, and then you got these other clowns out there trying to add to it. What are they trying to do? Make this country a total failure? We've got a chance.
Well, yeah, they are. Remember, the right wing is still owned wholly and totally by people like Grover Norquist, who says to this day he still wants to drown the government in a bathtub. That's the heart. You know, there was a lot of hand wringing after the election, Ed, where people said, well, you know, Kathleen Parker, who was a conservative columnist, she wrote a column saying that, you know, the right wing has to divorce itself from the religious extremists of the right wing fundamentalist literalist religion industry that sort of had the Republic, it was deemed, had the Republican Party by the throat. But even if you factor out the right wing religious weirdos from the Republican equation, you've still got people in there like Grover Norquist who literally hate our government.
Yeah.
How can you talk about drowning a government in the bathtub if you love your country?
Yep. Well, I've got one more, and then I'm going to get off of here. I just got company. But you were talking about how the right wing would do and not let you have your say, and that's exactly, if you don't conform, you know, your show lets anybody... You know, and I noticed the Republican that got on there the other night. You cut him a lot of slack, as far as I'm concerned. But the talk show that is on here of the morning, it is dictated to you what you're going to say, and that he can attack anybody in this nation. But when you start talking about him, and I'd give anything to know that he was listening. You know, he makes all of $150 a week, probably, and drinks and smokes and gas.
And ain't worth that, and is not worth half of that.
And no, but the fact of the matter is his wife's a nurse and supports him. And, you know, that to me is just hiding behind a woman's skirts. And, you know, what kind of scum suckers like that.
But Ed, what you're talking about there is the exact same, is exactly what Preston and I were discussing, and that is the fact that that's how right wingers operate. They tell you what to do, and you hear and listen and obey. Not even listen, just hear and obey. That is the that's the structure that is authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
I won't do it because A, I have no respect for it. And B, because it doesn't work in this context.
Yeah, well, that's the reason that we don't have that. Wayne and guys like myself are sort of in a boat by ourselves when we go out there, because everybody else sort of sucks up to that stuff. And Steve is their little god, and you know what he really knows and experience wise, you could put in a coffee cup. Maybe it would get at the bottom.
Well, you could put it in a coffee cup and not get your finger wet finding out if it was hot.
Right.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Ed, have yourself a wonderful weekend. You want to go back on hold?
You said you got company in there. I've got some company here, but I do want to call back in a few minutes. And if you get I'll tell you what, I'll just get off of here because I don't know, I don't know really what's going on,
that's my life, you know. I'm clueless.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the time. appreciate the conversations I've heard, and we'll be talking to you later, my friend.
All right. Take care, Ed. Bye now.
You too. Bye.
And let's keep things rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Going good. What's up, Rory?
Not much. Just getting a few last-minute things done here for Friday night, so I can go home and enjoy a Friday night.
Here, 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 here. I'm all over that in about an hour or so.
Yeah, right on, right on. Sorry to call in so late.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. What's up?
Just wanted to put it out there to your listeners that on Tuesday, December 9th, this upcoming Tuesday, Coal River Mountain Watch and the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition and the Anstead Historical Preservation Society and others we're going to be putting together, we're going to be having two press conferences to publicize and celebrate even the results of an economic analysis that was put together by Downstream Strategies over the past few months. They're out of Morgantown. And so this study that we commissioned basically has ended up proving that with numbers, which is apparently the only thing that can sway legislators, unfortunately.
Yeah, you just can't beat having facts on your side, can you?
Yeah, I know. I know. I mean, morality and ethics doesn't seem to get you anywhere. So that's why we got this report done, and Downstream Strategies came up with some amazing conclusions, and one being that wind power and wind development and wind manufacturing facilities are a significantly greater benefit to local economic development. So, and that proves it for Coal River Mountain, and it's really a landmark study that first case study that'll quantify environmental and social costs related to a.
Well, what kind? I mean, I don't want to steal any of the thunder from the press conference or anything, but what kind of data are we talking about?
Jobs, earnings, output, the environmental costs, basically it bunches together. There was a study back in the 70s that unfortunately hasn't been repeated too many times, but it shows what the total cost to environmental costs per ton of coal mined are in terms of dollars. And it's a very conservative estimate, but it's defensible. And so it'll show like what the total loss of ecosystem services, land value, forests, water, the contamination of water. So it quantifies all that together and puts a dollar value on it.
Well, you know, it's not going to be too awfully long before the West Virginia legislature meets.
Exactly.
And this couldn't come at a better time.
Yeah, I know. And there's a lot of things being proposed in the legislature in the coming session. And so a lot of folks are really excited about being able to use this to show what mountaintop removal is doing in terms of social and environmental costs and long-term economic costs to the areas here. So this report basically puts all that together for one case study, and the legislators are going to have to listen. So,
well, it's hard. Like you said, it's hard to turn away from something like facts.
Yep.
But then again, little brown bags full of dirty coal money make a lot of noise.
Yeah, they do, but hopefully little brown bags full of clean wind money will make even more noise. So,
well, you know, I talked at some length, I guess it was two nights ago, Rory, about the wonderful news coming out of Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And about the nexus that news like that has with the fact that just in the last week, Massey Energy has been told to write a check for $230 million.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
and so I think when you take those two factors, you bring together the honest to God serious data that you're talking about here, we're getting pretty close to something that I think we will soon be calling success.
I hope so. I hope so. I definitely feel that momentum. And it's all happened definitely like in the same span of, what, like 10 days?
Yeah. And you know what? I don't want to – granted, there's been a Wall Street bailout, and I support in some form the continued preservation of 3 million, you know, not 5,000 coal jobs in West Virginia, but 3 million automotive worker jobs in this country that can be put to work making, you know, hybrids, biodiesel, you know, stuff that isn't nearly as toxic to the planet. I don't want to see no Massey bailout. That's what I'm saying.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. That would, I think that would probably, I mean, especially since the bailout for Massey would be a bailout of their environmental and business violations, direct violations. So that's something I hope we don't see. But for, you know, the coal industry, though, they would have a hard argument to Congress saying, oh, we need money, because they've still made a profit this year. Actually, they made a pretty good killing this year with the high coal prices. So.
And what a word you just used, in so appropriate in more ways than one.
Made a killing, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's why I mentioned to Ed just a few minutes ago this thing that the coal industry, especially the mountaintop removal creeps, keep putting out there, that, you know, coal is our most abundant energy source.
Mm-hmm.
And
somebody even used the 250 to 400 years quote again recently.
Oh, God. But the fact of the matter is, all we have to do every time we see that is be in a position to point to the sky and say, see that? That is America's most abundant energy source. That cool wind you feel blowing across your face is America's most abundant energy source. And neither of it poisons communities. Neither of them kills workers.
That's right.
All we got to do is take the lies away from them, Rory.
Yep. And that's happening now. And to bring it back to the positive, of course, that's what I hope, that like we're going to be able to publicize this report to all the same major newspapers that wrote on the stream buffer zone rule and the Bank of America pull out of mountaintop removal investments. Because the fact that this report and the conclusions follow right on the heels of those is, to me, a really huge thing. And it's the perfect sort of follow-up for all that, you know. It's the icing on the cake, in my opinion. So we're going to be pushing this report really hard, and I'm hoping that every West Virginian learns about it and sees that clean energy and wind energy, is really abundant in West Virginia and is the best thing for the coal producing areas and for the state as a whole.
And the abundance has already been proven by the fact that they have been, wind projects have been successful in other parts of the state.
Right.
Back in
2002, True Wind Solutions, which is one of the national wind consulting firms, this is interesting. I found this out today. I thought True Winds had presented this to the state government in 2007 for the first time. But it was actually back in 2002, True Winds told West Virginia that there were nearly 4,000 megawatts of utility-scale wind potential in West Virginia. And that doesn't include all the great stuff along the Allegheny Front that's protected by state and national parks. So that's on private lands in West Virginia. And West Virginia didn't do anything about it until 2007.
Five years?
5 years. I've just found that out today.
That's astonishing.
Right, exactly. They knew where the wind was. The wind map was created for West Virginia. They knew where the wind was. They knew how much there was. They knew, actually, back in 2002, that Culver Mountain, I mean, they don't know this specifically, but Culver Mountain shows up on the state-level wind map. They knew that wind potential was there. They knew it.
And even so, the permitting process for the destruction of Coal River Mountain went forward.
Right. The permit for Beechery went forward in 2006. And then Eagle 2 followed this year.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, we've got something that we can put in their faces now. And I'm really proud of the work that was done by Downstream Strategies. Those are some darn fine researchers up there in Morgantown.
They really are, and they worked really hard on this. And
how long has this report been in the making, Rory?
I think they got started in July. We started discussion back in June, and they got started in July, probably near the end of July. And so they've done a lot of work over the past, I guess it'd be about 3 months.
Wow.
3.5 months.
So. And so a lot of this data will be coming out on Tuesday, December the 9th at 1:30 p.m. at Tamarack, and again at 4:30 in the governor's conference room in Charleston?
That's right.
Beautiful, beautiful. Exactly. Well, you know, I'm going to be there, so.
I know you are. I know you are. And your daughter is speaking at the first press conference.
That's what I'm hoping.
Okay.
All right.
Well, whenever I get the final report and there's some of the major conclusions in hand, I'll pass them along to you. And you.
That would be great, or even just the executive summary.
Yeah, you bet.
All right. Well, Rory, you've earned yourself a good weekend, brother.
Hey, thank you, bud.
All right. You take care.
Good talking to you, bud.
Bye now. That's Rory McElmoyle, Coal River Mountain Watch. He is the one who has put together a lot of the data, the scientific data that supports, underpins the Coal River Wind Project. And I'm looking to keep an eye on the major media, say long about Wednesday, for some coverage of this press conference, because this is in your face stuff. All these years of the right wing coal industry, and you know they are right wing. Don't kid yourself. The coal industry in this, especially the mountaintop removal industry in this state, is decidedly right wing, and we know what that phrase is really a substitute for. And they've said, well, you don't have anything to replace the good jobs. Now we do. Now it is abundantly clear. It is not necessary for people to blow up mountains in order to feed their family if only we get seriously behind the modern green economy that not can, but will change this nation. Not just West Virginia, not just Appalachia, the whole nation. You know, we talk about a greening of America, and the imagery is a beautiful thing. An America that is blossoming and growing. And it can happen. And a lot of it is getting started in the Coal River Valley. And you know darn good and well why it is I say what I do about Coal River Mountain Watch. The hardest working, bravest people that I know. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Hey, Dave, what's up?
Didn't think you'd get away with a whole week without me calling in, did you?
Well, I was beginning to wonder if you like fell down a well and we were going to have to get Lassie to go and find you.
Life's just been too interesting. Anyway, just listen. I'm going to kind of go backwards up my list here because that's what I do when I'm on hold. I kind of type things as I go. You were talking about Coal River and when people's starting to see it because of the work. The thing is, extreme situations are what tend to wake people up, and you know, mountaintop removal is just insanity. We need to find a way to make coal and put it underground, not dig it up.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I don't know. I'm always looking around at the science of the stuff, you know, the environment. And the bank losses that we're talking about right now, which are really fictitious money anyway, but the costs that we're talking about with the upcoming meltdown are dwarfed by the damage that's being done to the environment. I mean, this is nickel and dime stuff compared to the damage that's being done to the planet.
Well, that
it really is.
Yes, it
and
is.
Everyone's panicking about it, and the two things are so tightly interconnected that any person who would consider themselves a reasonable candidate to be the president of the most powerful country on the planet, unfortunately, that's what it is.
If not the most respectable.
Should be able to look this in the face and see that these two are connected and be honest. Well, that's what we need right now. If you resuscitate the corpse that is the present financial system, the planet is going to be destroyed. Simple as that. So this is a really big opportunity for anyone who has eyes.
Well, you know, you make me think of something. We're sitting and having a hissy about $25 billion for the auto industry, but we gave $700 billion with no strings attached to the financial industry. Maybe
that really blew my mind.
Oh, here. Well, I'll tell you what. Where the financial industry is concerned, let me give you a real knee slapper, a real belly jiggler. Here in West Virginia, here in West Virginia, we've got a bank called BB&T, and they're headquartered out of North Carolina. And the head of BB&T is one of those sort of hollow-eyed little followers of Ayn Rand. You're familiar with Ayn Rand, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
BB&T and he recently endowed a chair at Marshall University for the purpose of teaching Randian principles of economics. Right? $1 million or so.
Economics is nonsense from start to finish.
Well,
it's all based on assumptions that are self-evidently not true.
Well, you know, and within the Randian scheme, it's all about, well, rugged individualism, ego, the enlightened egoism, and the holiness of self-interest, and you know, it's up to business to bring, you know, to save the country, and government bad, and the moochers are out there stealing all of the labor of the hard-working libertarians. Mm-hmm. Remember all that?
Oh, yeah.
BB&T just signed on for about $3 billion worth of bailout money.
Are you surprised by this?
No, The first time I read it, Dave, I was reduced to paroxysms of laughter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes that's the only sane reaction to an insane world. You got to laugh. It's either laugh or run down the street screaming, really, isn't it?
It is.
There's sometimes where I find myself when I read the news in the morning.
Well, I mean, you just wish that there was some little liberal mommy and a liberal child, and they'd be standing on a street corner when the BB&T president goes by, and they go, "Hey, look, mommy, there goes the Randian hypocrite who's taken the welfare money. Look at the fool."
But the problem. I don't know. The thing that I find, something that, I mean, I'm terribly prone to seeing something and saying things to people. I can't help myself. I say, "Can you not see what the hell this is?" And sometimes at work, I say something, and I know the comments that behind me are kind of, "Oh, he's off again." And for me, when I hear that, I think, okay, I know what's happening here. You don't want to look at what I'm showing you.
Yeah, because it's too tough to stomach.
Yeah.
It's we're at a place in our development where, for many people, it's literally undigestible, Dave.
Yes, I know. And I don't understand why this is the case. This is the thing that I sometimes, and I said this to my kids, and they're 14 and 15, so they're at an age where I can say this. And I said, you know, I must be an alien, because this planet makes no sense to me. So I must be on the wrong one. And that's how I feel sometimes.
Clearly you are a Tralfamadorian, Dave.
I don't know what the hell I am, but I'm certainly not an Earthling. If what I see on the news and in the newspapers and in the mainstream media is the real world, then I'm on the wrong damn planet.
No, you're not. You're actually, no.
Okay, then I wish I was.
Well, okay, there is that. I'm looking at a news story here that just, missile shield shoot down test is success, Pentagon says.
It will make a lot of money for somebody because it's a success.
Yeah, well, that's what it's a success at. It's not a success at shooting down missiles.
Well, even if it's a success at shooting down missiles, it's not a success at keeping the world safe. That's the important thing.
Well, yeah, because, well, no, this is going to protect us from Korea and Iran.
But, I mean, if you don't go around pissing off every other country on the planet, then you don't need to be quite so damn paranoid, do you?
No, you really don't. And if you pay attention to concepts like blowback, then, the reason I brought this up, Dave, is you were talking about, you know, I'm on the wrong planet. No, what it is, though, is you're tuned into what is happening on this planet. And you're not willing to buy into the Soma-esque BS that is pumped through the family altar every day there in the corner of the room or hanging on the wall. And the reason I raise this missile shield shoot down test as a success story, Pentagon says, is because I read the whole thing. The Pentagon conducted a successful test Friday of a missile shield system designed to protect the United States against attack, spokesman Brian Whitman said. The test involved the interception of yada yada. It's what it involved, what the Pentagon said. There is not a paragraph in here that says the missile hit the missile.
No. But it's irrelevant. This is about selling something to the U.S. public as being acceptable and a really good idea. That then you can pour billions of dollars of taxpayers' money into some rich bugger's pocket. That's the scheme. That's the military-industrial complex.
Military-industrial-congressional complex, as it was originally called. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it. It really is.
And now it's expanded to the military, just by proven by stupid, phony journalism stories like this. It's the military-industrial-congressional media complex.
The security at the end of that. The security industry. The let's sell cameras and stuff that can listen in on people industry has absolutely boomed since 9/11.
Yes, it has.
And some of the technologies are truly intrusive and scary. And one of my daughter's just gone down to Disneyland from up here in Canada. And we had a meeting at the school about what was required, you know, passports and all this stuff.
Passports? And, from Canada? You know,
well,
there's
no,
a...
But it's a good idea. Passport's really straightforward. You don't need one.
Okay, we hadn't gotten...
Given I'm a Brit, I have a citizenship card. And I'm a Brit, so I have two passports. I have a Canadian and a Brit. And whenever I go down there, it's much simpler if you have a passport. It's much simpler if you're not driving a rental vehicle, too. That's an interesting concept. But the really bizarre thing about all this is my feeling on things like airport security is that it's not about safety or security. It's about getting the public used to unreasonable stop and search.
Right, so you can just get that pesky Fourth Amendment out of the way once and for all.
Yes.
And that's why one of the things that I will be, you know, there's some day one stuff. Obama wants a green stimulus bill on his desk on day one. I want some executive orders on his desk on day one that repeal the ripoff of habeas corpus. I want a bill on his desk undoing the stupid habeas corpus, the fandango that the Congress did in the last year. I want a bill on his desk that says we don't spy on our own people anymore. And those are job one, day one kinds of things as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because I'm not such a shameless partisan, Dave, that I think that what is bad, power that is bad for George Bush to have is good for Barack Obama to have. It is power that is bad for any individual to wield.
Absolutely.
And see, that's what sets us apart from the right wing.
A real big flag is going to be in the next year if the incoming administration doesn't go after Bush and Cheney for their crimes, then they're setting it up in such a way that any president from here on in can do whatever the hell he wants to do and get away with it.
That risk, that risk does exist. Anything else on the list, Dave?
It's not just a risk. It's something that's unless something sends a big message, it's going to happen. I don't think it's a risk. I think
it's a certainty.
The other side, it's a risk that it might not, but I don't think it's a big risk from that side. I really think it's going to happen, and it's a frightening thought.
I think we're talking about the same thing. The risk that they will be allowed to get away with it.
Well, like I say, I don't think it's a risk. I think it's almost a certainty that they will. And it sets up so.
And that's that is a damn shame. And it will be the repetition of one of the most profound early mistakes that Bill Clinton made. And that is to let the Iran-Contra thugs slide.
Yes.
And by Iran-Contra thugs, I mean George H.W. Bush.
But this is why, and I was typed in earlier. This is why I have such a high opinion of politicians, because they're. To me, it just looks like, you know, you buggers are all in it together. You all lie your backsides off. I mean, I said earlier, how can you tell when a politician's lying? You can see his lips move. That's really how I feel about the whole deal. You can't trust them as far as you can spit. And
well, they're like water.
No,
they seek their own level, and they have defined what their own level is.
Yeah.
And it's right. Really, really low.
Yes.
You know, there's a breaking story that Nancy Pelosi is switching sides now. She didn't. There was money set aside to help Detroit move over toward greener or hybrid vehicles, and she was opposed to using that for the bailout. And now there's the breaking story that she may be going to change her mind on it. And use the money that was supposed to produce hybrid, green, you know, more eco-friendly vehicles, going to use that for the bailout. And I find that profoundly disturbing.
Well, the whole bailout concept right now, it seems like everyone's after a bailout now. But as far as the car business goes. The way it seems to be going right now is the bailout's going to be used as a way of destroying the auto industry's union. That's how it looks to me. The concessions required from the union to get this bailout through is going to be lower wages, fire everyone right now, rehire people at lower wages with no health
benefits. Oh, don't forget, cancel out the pension and the health care for the people who already gave their lives to the company.
Exactly. That's where this bailout, who the hell is it bailing out? It's not bailing out the people who really deserve to be bailed out, the people who have been ripped off by the rich bastards. Sorry, I get really angry.
No, I understand that completely. I've got one more call I want to hit, though, Dave, and sorry, I'm not trying to cut anything short. But,
no, that's fine. I completely understand, you know. You got to get as many rants in there as you can.
Well, you know, it's Friday. I don't want anybody spontaneously combusting over the weekend.
Yeah, the pressure builds up.
It does indeed. Anyway, take care and have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
All right.
Relax as much as you can, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Later.
Good night.
Bye now. And hope your daughter enjoys Disney World, too. Well, I didn't get to the... These things happen. Well, so we'll end on time after all. Still had a bunch of other stuff to go through. Oh, darn. We'll hit it Monday. Thanks, everybody, for joining in for what was a wonderful Friday for me. I hope it was for you as well. And don't forget the weekend schedule. Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. The Rick Smith Show coming to you out of Pennsylvania. Night Sounds with Billy Shears, and then on Sunday evening, All Foxed Up with John Fox. It's a fun little weekend lineup here. And in the meantime, I'll look forward to Monday, as I hope you will as well. Sometimes weekends can be tough. But it's nice to recharge the batteries, as it were, as well. Thank you to Peter Godbold and John Fox, our IT professional and chief engineer, respectively. Thank you to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk. WhiteRoseSociety.org is responsible for everything that streams to you, that is horn programming, as well as a whole lot of other liberal programming as well. Ben Birch almost single-handedly saved liberal talk on the Internet. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColRiverWind.org. If you haven't, there's still time to call Joe Manchin's office and tell him to do the right thing and move quickly, promptly, to save Coal River Mountain and to save the best future that West Virginia has. And this country. This is a leadership thing. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Third time's a charm. Is it too early for Thorazine cocktails on a Friday evening? I have no idea what just happened. Everything's all right, and all the things are in their happy places, and you press all the buttons, and... Now, it's kind of like watching the Millennium Falcon try to go into warp or something. Aw, not again, Chewie. Only on a Friday. Well, you know what this means? Last night I had this feeling that, it was going to be a really good show. Tonight, I don't know. I may punch the phone button and just have little bats fly through the air. I need a keeper. I need a handler. I need a staff. You know what we need. I'm not starting the show that way again. I just wanted to go take a bath after last. I hate starting the show with a money pitch. Yuck! Heldahl shooters for everybody. Oh well. Now there's some fun stuff to go into this evening, especially after the way I closed the show last night. But I tell you, it's Friday. And rather than me sitting here and babbling my fool head off, this is live, by the way. This is Accept no substitutes, and don't try this at home. I am a trained broadcaster.